Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, heck, we gotta work.
Okay.
Work, I called it. Good evening. Welcome to Erie House Radio. Old Tiny Radio, no less. I'm Dale Kay from Spook Show. Here, along with...
I am not Cleveland Brown, but I do have an explanation for that. I am Dave Binkley from The Weirdest Really Bad Movie and Spaceship One.
All right.
And we're here with...
I'm no lumberjack, but I'm logged in. Here's I, got to go, blab to you all.
He's a lumberjack.
Super squirrel.
He's,
okay. He's a lumberjack.
And he's okay. That's right.
And he's okay.
I like the press wild flowers.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
I have an explanation for my...
He sleeps all day.
Yep. And he puts on women's clothes. Okay. Anyway.
Hey.
I have an explanation. We were talking about... calls and names before, and apparently the person that had my cell phone number before I had it was a guy that was actually named Cleveland Brown. And Cleveland Brown actually left a lot of debt around town. And so I started getting all the, for, I still get them from time to time, harassing calls for Cleveland Brown. And the first time I got it, they asked for Cleveland Brown, and I just burst out laughing. And they said, what? I said, you're kidding, right? I said, no. I said, Cleveland Brown? Really? But anyway.
Is that a baseball team? What is Cleveland Brown?
It'd be a football team, yes. Yes.
Football, okay.
Pizza ball.
All right.
Pizza ball.
Okay. I could have said tennis. I'm not really good with the sports. You know?
You would have not been right with that one either. Yeah.
It's the
kickball team, isn't it? You kick a ball?
They kick
Cleveland
a ball.
Browns? They're kicking a ball. Kicking a ball, catching a ball, kicking a ball, catching a ball. Touchdown. We win. Okay.
We got a lot of radio tonight.
We got a whole lot of radio.
Oh,
my goodness.
You
confess? I'm not confessing to anything.
Well, I have a lawyer right beside me, so I know I won't say anything that's too far wrong.
Well, wait. I'll confess for $5.
They say confession is good for the soul. Hey, whole religions are built on this concept, right? No, we're not doing that. We're doing movies about...
Oh, my gosh.
Movies? No, radio shows about crime-type confessions.
Oh, my. I'm signed in wrong.
I thought we had a new listener.
I just let them know
that you are the amazing secret squirrel.
I need to find the new one. Oh, no. Oh, there it is. Okay. All right. There it is. Let me log out. Secret squirrel. Yes. I am secret squirrel a long time ago.
My nephew.
Secret squirrel.
Nephew.
Where's Morocco? That's what I want to know.
Let's go secret. To the secret mobile. Yeah, that guy.
Oh, my God.
Three radio shows. Yeah, we're doing some tonight. Like as not.
Okay, I have to sign out. Okay, I'm signing out. Oh, boy. How do I do this?
That's right. We have three. We have Inner Sanctum, The Whistler, and The 11th Hour.
Ooh.
Ooh. What? Wait, what happened? Now I'm lost. I don't know what I did. Am I logged out?
No.
I'm not.
My luck doesn't
go
that good.
Okay, so we have The Whistler and The Whistler's mother. Is that in something else?
No.
And
The Whistler and The 11th
Hour?
The Whistler and the 11th Hour, yes.
Blog uses cookies. Yeah, got okay, whatever.
All right, thank you for narrating your login process. We got radio to do.
Here's my password. Inner Sanctum Mysteries.
You can never have tea again.
Never. Says log out and I press the button.
I never thought I'd hear myself say this, but Garnet, you need some coffee.
I need something. This is Am I logged out? Now I think I'm logged out. Maybe. No?
I recommend barbiturates.
I'm not happy with Log Talk not letting me log out.
Neither am I.
It says log out. I pressed a button. It says we couldn't find it at that page. What's wrong
with
it?
We got a lot of radio tonight.
We got a whole lot of radio. Homepage. Log out.
Don't make me play hardball with you.
Hey, Bill, reach inside this computer and log me out. Kick me out of the show. I don't know what you need to do.
So that's what you've been up to.
Settings.
I'm trying to get booted.
I don't know what I have no idea what's going on. I don't know. Where am I?
That would be good.
Yeah. No, don't ban Secret. He's a good guy.
Hey, Gar, quick question.
Heck?
Gar,
yes.
Quick question. Remember
yes.
why we're here?
Oh, whole lot of radio. Whole lot of radio. I don't know what to do.
I do.
Lost it. August 8th, 1949, we had a radio show.
Anyway, where will we start?
Oh, okay.
Well, you know what? The Whistler would be a good place to start, wouldn't it? Because we could use a little bit of wind. We could use a little bit of wind right now.
We could. We need
a little bit more.
Yes. I can't believe this.
This one, oddly enough, fitting our motif, if you will, is entitled "The Confession," and it's from.
Oh, August 21st. 1949. There we go. It's in there somewhere.
And now,
we got a whole lot of radio.
A program that has rated top 10 popularity for a longer period of time than any other West Coast program in radio history. The Signal Oil program, The Whistler.
Signal gasoline.
Signal, the famous Go Farther gasoline, invites you to sit back and enjoy another strange story by The Whistler. For extra driving pleasure, the signal to look for is the yellow and black circle sign that identifies Signal service stations from Canada to Mexico. And for Sunday evening listening pleasure, the signal to listen for is this whistle that identifies the Signal Oil program, The Whistler.
I am The Whistler. And I know many things, for I walk by night. I know many strange tales, hidden in the hearts of men and women who have stepped into the shadows. Yes, I know the nameless terrors of which they dare not speak.
And now the Whistler's strange story, Confession.
The group around Dr. Rourke's bed moved away as he beckoned with his last remaining strength, indicated that he wanted to be alone with his son. It was all right, the nurse decided, because his boy, James Rourke, was a doctor himself. She directed the others out, moved silently after them, and closed the door. James sat on the edge of the bed and listened at what his father had to say. It was an amazing story, something the dying man had to clear up. It wasn't really his own story, but that of one Tony Delgano, former public enemy number one. It was late. The steamer dock almost deserted when the big car pulled up near the gangplank. And Tony Delgano stepped out and turned to the driver.
Salidi.
Yeah, Tony?
Not Tony, you fool. You want me picked up before this tub even sails?
Okay, okay, not Tony. What do you got on your passport?
Tony Delgado is no more. The boss is now David Delmas.
Delmas? Kind of close, isn't it, Mikhail?
It should be close, Chief, so you don't slip.
I'm not slipping. To see that you guys don't. You do any singing, Saliti, one little bit.
Why do you always think I'm going to be the opera star? I don't sing to nobody.
See that you don't.
You better go aboard, Chief.
Yeah. Nice trip, Mr. Delmar.
Go on, get back in the car. Here, Chief, here's your passport.
Thanks, Mikhail. You're okay.
I'll keep an eye on Saliti for you, don't worry. You'll make it, Chief.
Sure. Sure, I always have. Well, so long, Mikhail. Don't take any lead slugs.
You watch from the rail as the lights from the Golden Gate fade into the distance. And you feel safe, secure, don't you, Tony? It's like the beginning of a new life. One that's free of the police. A new life under another name, David Delmas. You enjoy it even more only a few hours later at a cocktail party on board, when you manage a meeting with a very exciting girl, Sharon Phillips. You feel a sense of amusement inside as you introduce yourself in the ship's lounge.
No, not at all.
Delmas, David Delmas.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Mr. Delmas.
Well, they say that shipboard friendships sometimes lead to all kinds of things.
No.
May I get you another cocktail?
If you like. Manhattan, please.
Sure.
Oh, just a moment. I want you to meet someone. An old friend.
Oh?
Doctor. Dr. Rourke.
Rourke.
Over here, Doctor.
Oh, hello, Sharon. So you decided to take the trip after all.
Dr. Rourke, Mr. Delmas.
Hi.
How do you do?
I'll get that drink for you, Sharon.
Oh, and hurry back, won't you?
Yeah, sure.
It's a shock, isn't it, Tony, seeing Dr. Rourke? And you know that it surprised him, too. It's been a long time, hasn't it? And you know that you must talk to him alone and soon. He's gone when you return with Sharon Phillips' drink. But later, out on the deck, you see him standing by the aft rail, quietly smoking his pipe, and you saunter over.
Well, we meet again, Dr. Rourke.
Oh, yes. I wondered when you'd be cornering me alone, Mr. Delgado.
Delmas. David Delmas.
I don't suppose I have to ask you why you're traveling under an assumed name. The police again.
Yeah, the police again. But, Doc...
Yeah?
You're going to keep my secret. Not say anything.
Am I?
You haven't said anything yet.
No. No, I haven't.
You're wise, Doc. Very wise. I could mess up your life, too, you know.
In what way?
There's your memory, Doc, the time you fixed up my shoulder after that hunting accident.
I remember.
Sure. And you remember it wasn't a hunting accident at all.
I learned that later, Tony.
Make it Dave. David Delmas.
Don't tell me what to make it. I'll say what I please, when and to whom. You can't threaten me, Delgado.
Sure, I know. Your son, he's a doctor too, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
I wonder how his associates would feel if they heard his old man, Dr. Rourke Sr., had helped a criminal and never said anything about it.
My son, you wouldn't...
I would. So just forget Tony Delgado. Or your son, young Dr. Rourke, will have his life messed up for good.
I see. You're running away, I suppose?
Yeah, you suppose good, Doc. What are you doing? One of your own prescriptions, maybe? A little sea voyage?
I'm doing a favor for a friend.
Oh? Is he on board?
Yes.
Don't go getting any ideas you can tell him about me. I want no one to know, Doc, till I'm free and clear. Then it doesn't make any difference.
I understand.
Just skip mentioning anything to your friend. Understand that, too.
It would scarcely matter if I did. My friend is making his last voyage.
Oh?
His body is in a casket
in the hold. I'm escorting him to his final resting place. His last request.
Oh. Okay, Doc. I guess you won't do any talking. I'll see you around.
Not if I can avoid it.
Oh. Did I hurt your feelings, old man? Well, forget it, see? I'll call on you any time for anything, and you'll do whatever Tony Delgado says. Sorry, I forgot my new name. Delmas. David Delmas. He speaks a little differently from Delgado. Now, Delmas is going to be a real gent. But he's the same guy, Doc. The same guy.
H.F. Hansen of San Diego is the Whistler fan to whom we are sending a $20 Signal gasoline book this week as a token of our appreciation for writing this limerick. There was a young man from Del Mar who traded his horse for a car. After many a test, he found Signal gas best, 'cause it made his new car go so far.
Signal, Signal, Signal gasoline. Your car will go far with Go-Father gasoline.
We're glad that our friend from Del Mar found Signal gas best, but he really wouldn't have had to make all those tests if he had just followed the lead of that increasing number of drivers who each year are switching to Signal. In fact, so many drivers have switched to Signal that the number of independent Signal stations has grown and grown, from a modest beginning in Southern California into an organization serving 6 Western states, from Canada to Mexico. Wouldn't you like to discover what has made so many folks prefer Signal gasoline above all others? Then next time your gas tank gets thirsty, just remember the advice on those Signal billboards you've seen. Next time, fill up with Signal, the famous Go Farther gasoline.
Clear sailing again, isn't it, Tony? As David Delmas, you're safe on the ship. Not a worry. And Dr. Rourke will say nothing. Because he's afraid that his son, a young doctor with a bright future, will be hurt for the knowledge that his father once helped a criminal. He took a bullet out of your shoulder, didn't he, Tony? After a bank job. He didn't know. But it's the same now after all these years. He'd never be believed. And you'll take any advantage to be safe. You think very little about it the next few days. You're too busy with that girl, Sharon Phillips. She's exciting, isn't she, Tony? And seemingly very interested in you.
Oh, you won again. David, I'm afraid I'm no shuffleboard player.
Oh, David, I like you to call me that, Sharon.
Mm. David, what do? You work, I mean.
Why do you ask that?
Oh, no reason, except that, well, we have been seeing a good deal of one another. I asked Dr. Rourke if he knew anything
about... Rourke, what did he say?
Why, nothing. Nothing at all. That's why I asked you.
Oh. Sharon, I'm just a guy moving about seeking...
Seeking?
Yeah. Something, someone like you.
David, the steward's coming. I don't think...
Oh, the fool. What is it, Stuart?
Mr. Delmas, could I see you alone, sir?
Sure, sure. We'll dance twice around the main funnel. What do you want?
Later then, sir. Alone.
Look, what is this?
I don't mind, David. I'll join you later. Mr. Long.
Not much later. 10 minutes, Sharon. Now, boy.
Easy, Tony.
What?
I might not like that.
Tony, where did you...
I've seen your picture.
So what?
This, Mr. Delgado. This radiogram from San Francisco, from Mr. David Delmas.
Yeah, let me see. The lady's singing received well here. Anticipate big reception for you in Australia, McHale. So, lady, that double-crossing little squealer, if I...
Tip off the cops, huh?
If I ever get my hands
on... Save your breath, Mr. Delgado. You can still lick him from here. You got a Sunday punch.
Huh?
Yeah. Your friend, Dr. Rourke.
What about Rourke?
He's escorting a stiff, isn't he?
So?
So? What's to prevent us from, disposing of his quiet friend? You take his place in the casket, go ashore as nice as you please. Nobody's the wiser.
Hey, you're a bright boy, boy. And your end of it?
Just give me a little help, that's all.
Help?
Yeah. Maybe you could get a little package ashore for me.
What's in it?
$1 million in diamonds. You just take it in with you, deliver it to me later. We both get a break. I'll pick it up after you're safe on shore. What do you say?
I'll have to think it over. I'll get in touch with you.
Okay. But remember, it's your only chance.
It's a way out, isn't it, Tony? But you're not certain you want to take it. You tell yourself there must be another way you can escape the police. We'll be waiting for you when your boat docks at Sydney. In the days that follow, you search for the answer. Find yourself thinking more and more of the steward's plan. Then one evening, as you stroll along the half-deserted deck.
Evening, Mr. Delmas. Beautiful night, isn't it?
Yes, yes, it is, Steward. Do you have a light?
Righto. Here you are, sir.
Thanks.
Oh, been a pleasant voyage, wouldn't you say, sir? Too bad it'll all be over soon. Dock day after tomorrow, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
By the way, Mr. Delmas, Miss Phillips has been inquiring about you.
What?
Asked if I'd seen you. She's in the lounge.
Oh, thanks.
Nice young lady, that Miss Phillips. Seems quite taken by you.
Yeah.
If I may say so, sir.
That's so?
I got eyes, you know. Yes, sir. Very attractive woman. Lots of money, too, I hear. Too bad if anything happened to spoil your beautiful friendship. Like the police. Hey, Mr. Delmas?
Yeah, it would be too bad.
Been thinking any more about my proposition?
Sure, I've been thinking about it.
It's a deal?
It's a deal. Bring the package to my stateroom in 10 minutes.
The tension mounts, as it always does for The Whistler, a great great radio program. Haven't had these guys in a while.
Nope, and you're hearing Jeff Chandler in this episode of The Whistler. Mr. Boynton from Armis Brooks, he was the Michael Shane from the second radio series of Michael Shane, and movie star on top of that.
Yes, he was. Big time.
Another fun little bit about this is it's brought to us by Signal Gasoline Company, which was Signal Gas and Oil. They started out in 1922, and they started doing the Whistler in 1942. And they eventually, it's like whatever became of, because we hear so many radio programs, and it's like, what about these weird things that they're talking about? Dick Tracy, Dakota Rings. Where can you get them? Oh, they're on eBay. But this guy, Signal Oil or Signal Gasoline, actually turned into Honeywell. That's what it eventually became. After all the mergers and everything, 1999. Allied Signal was the last iteration and became Honeywell.
Yep, it was a West Coast gasoline company. And so this show actually was only West Coast. Now, they did have some people that did the same scripts with a different sponsor in Chicago, but that was only for like a year or two out of the entire run of Whistler. And it was just very, very, I've seen a couple of the Chicago scripts. I mean, basically, they're the same thing. They just had a different sponsor. And they had different actors in Chicago acting out the parts. So it's kind of odd that everybody knew about it, but they did. And, of course, TV helped that, and there was a series of Whistler movies on top of that. So, you know, they're just so many of these things they ran. And, of course, well, no, there wasn't. I was going to say there probably was a comic book, wasn't there? You'd have to tell me.
Yeah.
Of the Whistler?
Either a graphic novel or a comic book, yeah.
I wonder
no,
if Dell ever tells you. I don't know.
No.
It was before. No, this is pre-Dell. Right. There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are. Oh wow. Now I'm seeing Charlton comic pictures in my head. Yeah. It was wild about the signal. Because we're in seven states, and it's like, oh, that's it.
This is just another fine example of the. You know, you got an anthology series like The Whistler with a great host. And I think that's what inspired all these other things, the movies, the comics. That had various levels.
And Hunt. And Honeywell.
And it turned out to be Honeywell. Honey. Well.
Which reminds me of another job I had, but we'll talk about that later. I used to sell Honeywell components back in the day. But anyway, we'll keep going. I did. Seriously. What didn't this guy do? I got fired a lot. No,
what a shock.
Are you into the coffee again?
He might have to beat your own record.
Yeah, here we go. I need to go get a job today so I can get fired from that, too.
You know I love you, brother.
Love you, too, brother. Brother man.
I have not, but I knew a bartender. Is that close? I'm not a drinker, so it wouldn't have.
It's never too late to start.
No, that's right. That's right. I am drinking tea. Oh, no. Yeah, but.
I think
well,
I
stick
have
a little Long
a,
Island.
Yes.
Stick a little Long Island in there, and you'll be fine.
I don't know.
Fog Vane says I'd be a great bartender. Okay.
All right. Why not? Hold on.
I'd go out in a dog costume to try to get people to come into the bar.
We are going to wrap up the Whistler.
The Whistler. Yeah.
Yeah.
There we go.
And it's the confession. Let's find out how this ends. And during the
it ends
segment, I'm sending Gar a picture. I'm going to send Gar a picture from the Whistler comic book.
Okay, cool. Yes. Which
it's
what
a package.
Is this? Where
all
are you?
Wrapped up nice and proper.
It's not a very big one, is it?
Well, not very, but it's worth $1 million.
What's your cut?
$20,000 on delivery.
All right, beat it. I'll take care of things from now on.
Is Dr. Rourke in it?
Not yet, but I'll handle him.
You understand that part's between you and the doc.
Sure.
Well, got to get topside.
All right, just a minute.
Yeah?
How do I get this package to you when I'm ashore?
Don't worry, Tony. I'll be close by all the time.
After he's left your cabin, your gaze wanders back to the small package lying on the desk. You stare at it for a moment. Then quickly you walk over to it and rip it open. You're examining the contents of the package when quickly you close the box. Slip it into the desk drawer.
Come in.
Hello, David.
Oh, Sharon. Come in.
I was beginning to wonder where you disappeared to.
Well, I was just on my way up to the lounge.
Oh. The Fenways have asked a few people to their stateroom. Want to go along?
Have I been invited?
Oh, have you? Mrs. Fenway won't take no for an answer.
What's the occasion?
Oh, nothing special. There'll be drinks and cards, I suppose. Mrs. Fenway has suddenly discovered the game of blackjack. She's crazy about it.
Wait till she starts losing.
Oh, come on, David. The Fenways are waiting.
I have to go up on deck for a minute, Sharon. Oh. Why don't you run along? I'll join you later.
Oh? All right.
Go on, honey. It's important I take care of this matter right away. Very important. Oh, Steward.
Huh? Oh, Mr. Delmas. I didn't see you. Rather dark here.
Yeah. Yeah, nice and dark.
Out for a bit of a stroll?
I am. Join me?
Well,
come on, it's business. You'd like to make 10 grand easily, wouldn't you, Stuart?
10 grand?
When I left the States, there was a reward out on me. 10 grand.
Is that so?
Yeah, that's so. You knew about that, didn't you?
Why, no. No, I didn't.
You figured you'd like to collect, didn't you?
Why, I don't know what you're talking about.
You wanted to hide me out where the cops couldn't find me, then you'd lead them to me. How am I doing?
Oh, that's crazy. Why would I turn you in for 10 grand when you're holding a package for me that's worth 20?
Uh-uh. I opened it, Buster.
You opened it?
Yeah. All I found was a handful of dime store glass.
How about it? No, wait a minute. You got me all wrong.
Oh, I don't think so.
What are you going to do?
You're a smart punk. You can figure it out, can't you?
It was easy, wasn't it, Tony? The steward won't bother you anymore. Sharon and the rest of the passengers will think he's fallen overboard. When you retire for the night, you're confident you're in the clear, that your plan can't fail. Then the following morning, there's a knock on your stateroom door.
Come in.
Your breakfast, sir.
Oh, thank you. Set it down here, will you?
Yes, sir.
You're new, aren't you? Where's the other steward I had?
Well, it's rather odd, sir. He disappeared.
What?
The ship has been searched. He isn't aboard.
Are you sure?
Yes, sir. One of the passengers on the deck last night thought he heard a splash.
You mean the steward might have fallen overboard?
That's exactly what might have happened, Mr. Delmar.
Oh, Dr. Rock. Good morning.
Good morning.
That'll be all, Stuart.
Yes, sir.
Too bad about the steward falling overboard, wasn't it?
Yeah, tough. Well, accidents will happen.
I don't think it was an accident.
You join me, Doctor?
Well, thanks. I've already had breakfast.
The eggs look good. You sure you won't
No.
have... You were saying, Doctor...
It wasn't an accident, was it?
Accident? Oh, you mean the steward.
How does it feel to be a murderer? I've often wondered.
Have some coffee, Doc?
He knew too much about you, didn't he? I noticed from the first day when he saw us talking together, he was rather inquisitive in a guarded sort of way. Probably recognized you.
He was a smart little operator, Doc, but not smart enough. I hated to do it, especially after he'd given me that bright idea.
What bright idea?
Way of getting off this boat. You see, the police are going to be waiting for me when the boat docks in Sydney.
What?
Mm-hmm. Sit down, Doc. Sit down. You know, it's going to be tough for both of us if they grab me. Tough on your son, too.
What are you going to do?
Well, there's a way I can slip past them, if you'll help. And I'm pretty certain you will, Doc.
How?
You told me you're accompanying an old friend to his final resting place.
Yes, that's right.
Sure. And that's how I'm going to slip off this boat. They'll never think of looking there for me.
You're not suggesting that...
Right again. We make a switch.
No, I can't do that. I won't.
Relax, Doc, relax.
You can't ask me to do such a thing.
I'm not asking, I'm telling. What's more, you'll keep your mouth shut or you know what happens to your son. Now beat it, huh?
Now, listen to me.
We'll be docking tomorrow night. I'll let you know in plenty of time. Plenty of time.
You watch Dr. Rourke as he backs out of your stateroom, a stunned, horrified look on his face. You're not worried, are you, Tony? You know he'll go through with it for his son's sake. You spend the rest of the day with Sharon, enjoying the deck games, chatting pleasantly with the other passengers. And then early that evening, when you've just finished dressing for dinner, you pour yourself a drink. A knock on your stateroom door interrupts your first sip. One of the ship's officers steps into the room.
Yes, what is it?
I'll have to ask you to come with me, sir.
Oh?
Captain wants to see you.
What about?
You'll come quietly, Mr. Delgano.
Delgano?
We've just received a radiogram from the San Francisco police.
Oh, I see. Would mind if I finish my drink? Would you care for one?
If you'll come with me, sir.
Oh, come on. Have a drink.
An instant after you throw the drink in his face, your fist connects with his chin, and he slumps to the floor. Quickly, you close the door, stand for a moment with your back to it, your mind spinning wildly. They've discovered you now, haven't they, Tony? And you've got to move fast. Leaving the unconscious officer sprawled out on the floor, you hurry to Dr. Rourke's stateroom.
That's what I said. Now. It's got to be now.
But we don't dock until tomorrow.
Sure, but as soon as that officer wakes up, they'll be tearing this boat inside out looking for
me. Please, Delgado, don't ask me.
Look, I haven't got time to argue. Get going. I'll wait here for you.
The minutes drag by and you wait for Dr. Rourke to return. Pace his stateroom floor, stopping occasionally to pour yourself a drink from the decanter on the nightstand. An hour goes by, and then finally...
Where have you been?
I had to be careful.
Is everything all set?
Yes, I just had a talk with the captain.
What? Are you double-crossing?
No, wait. I told him I thought I saw you trying to hide in one of the lifeboats. Huh? Saw you lose your footing.
Oh, I see.
The boat is circling the area now.
Hey, pretty smart. Pretty smart, Doc. Yeah, that calls for a drink.
Well, I could use one.
I see you've helped yourself.
Yeah, I've had a few. It'll make me feel better while I'm resting in that box down below.
Tony, there's something I've got to
tell
you.
Look, we've talked enough.
But this is important.
I know all I need to know. Now, come on, finish your drink. We're going down into the hole where you can make me nice and comfortable.
But Tony,
I said come on. I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Very well. You seem to be giving the orders.
Here's some hot weather mathematics for drivers. Take the temperature of the day, add 2,800 degrees, the temperature inside the cylinder head of the average motor. That adds up to a lot of heat. Good reason why your motor needs the protection of the improved type Signal oil that's engineered to stand up under heat. Signal Premium Compounded Motor Oil. You see, in addition to 100% pure paraffin base, Signal Premium contains scientific compounds that do things which oil alone cannot do. One of these compounds, for instance, keeps Signal Premium from breaking down at high temperatures and forming harmful gum or varnish. Another compound prevents bearing corrosion. And still another compound actually removes carbon. That's why we call Signal Premium the oil that does so much more than just lubricate. So if you want your motor to stay young, get your next oil change at a Signal station. Change to the improved type Signal oil that stands up under heat. Signal Premium Compounded Motor Oil.
In stunned silence, young Dr. Rourke sat on the edge of his father's bed, listening to the dying man as he told his story in a voice that had now faded to a bare whisper. The end was near for the elder Dr. Rourke, and as his son James leaned forward to catch the last few remaining words, an expression of horror across his face.
Dad. Dad, you let Tony Delgado get away?
No. No, son. Didn't get away.
But you let him take another man's place in the casket. Your friend.
Yes. He took my friend's place in the casket. The body I was accompanying to its final resting place. But, you see, there was something Tony Delgado didn't know.
Oh, what was that, Dad?
That my friend had chosen as his final resting place a burial at sea, somewhere near Australia.
That whistle be your signal for the Signal Oil program, The Whistler, each Sunday night at this same time. Brought to you by the Signal Oil Company, marketers of Signal gasoline and motor oil, and fine quality automotive accessories. Remember, if you would like the fun of having your friends hear a limerick of yours on The Whistler, the address to which to send it is Signal Oil Company, Los Angeles, California. All limericks become the property of Signal Oil Company. Those selected for use on the Whistler will be chosen by our advertising representatives on the basis of humor, suitability, and originality. So, of course, they must be your own composition. Featured in tonight's story were Ira Grossell and Herb Butterfield. The Whistler was produced by George W. Allen, directed by Sterling Tracy, with story by Joel Malone and Adrian John Doe. Music by Wilbur Hatch, and was transmitted to our troops overseas by the Armed Forces Radio Service. The Whistler is entirely fictional, and all characters portrayed on the Whistler are also fictional. Any similarity of names or resemblance to persons living or dead is purely coincidental. Remember, at this same time next Sunday, another strange tale by The Whistler. Robert Miller speaking with the CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
And that was The Whistler. We'll continue with more confessions. Keep letting that wind out. More confessions coming up after this. Eerie House Radio proudly presents Gar's Moral of the Story.
With apologies to Dave, a burial at sea is an easy decision to make when you understand how impossible it is to swim a backstroke in a cemetery.
One problem with burial at sea is that what if you don't know how to swim?
Yeah, well, I don't think it matters, but...
And then you're swimming with the mermaids, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, but I like that. I like, yeah, you can't swim a backstroke in a cemetery. That'll be in the book.
There you go. It's in the book.
There's a book coming.
It's in the book. I'm making a coffee table book, Gar's Moral of the Stories, 8 years of torture. Yeah, it's going to be great.
It's not torture. It's torture waiting for the next one. That's all.
Ooh. Which could be the inner sanctum mysteries.
It
or
could
not.
Be that, yes.
I don't know. Where are we going with that? What is that one?
By gosh, it will be.
Why not?
Okay.
Me?
Sure. Inner Sanctum Mysteries comes from, I don't know. Tell us, Dave.
Oh, you want a date, do you? Well.
No, not a date. I know the date.
I'm sorry,
no,
but I'm
not. Where did it come from?
It is from January 22nd.
No.
19. Oh, no, no.
It's from Minnesota. No? It's from New England?
No.
Saskatchewan.
Burbank?
Poughkeepsie.
It's from New York. That's where Hyman Brown was.
It's from New York.
Hyman Brown was in New York.
Inner Sanctum. There you go. Anything special about this particular episode Dave?
Who's our host tonight?
46, it would probably be Paul McGrath.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Another one of the great radio shows. Fairly well known. This one's called The Confession, and it's from
January 22nd, 1946.
What's
wrong? What is wrong?
Good evening, Creed. This is Hunter Galloway opening the doors of the Mystery Playhouse. Tonight our stage will be taken over by Inner Sanctum, and as usual, you'll get a chuckle or two and an excellent mystery story from Inner Sanctum's host, Raymond. We're at your door, Mr. Host, so open it, won't you? Good evening, friends of the inner sanctum. Welcome. Come right in. There's room enough for everybody. As a matter of fact, the more bodies, the better. Don't be surprised by the gloom. It's our new paint job in black so the bloodstains won't show. And now, friends, draw up your chairs. Dim the lights and listen to a story designed to freeze the spine and set the teeth on edge. It was written by Michael Sklar and Richard Manoff, and it's called The Confession. Our star is Santa Sotega, who plays the role of Alex.
The last thing I remembered was the gunshot, the thud of the bullet, and the burning pain in my stomach. And everything got black. When I regained consciousness, my impression was of blinding whiteness.
There, don't try to move, Mr. Sturgis.
Where am I?
This is the emergency ward of the General Hospital.
I felt no pain. Just an overall numbness. And a desire to sleep. Am I going to die?
Yes.
How much time have I got?
A couple of hours.
Doctor, I want to make confession. I want to confess to murder. I told the doctor about the money and Lenore. She was much younger than I. And she thought because I owned a little drugstore, I must be prosperous. And I suppose that's why she married me in spite of the difference in our ages. But there wasn't any money for fun or nice clothes. So she became restless. But I loved her. And I did my best. Until the other night, in the drugstore. Oh,
12 o'clock, Nathan. Time to close up, Alex.
5 more minutes, dear. Another customer might come along.
Just like an old man, chasing pennies, never getting anything out of life.
Be reasonable, dear. I'm trying to make a living for it.
Is this your idea of a living? Is this what you promised me before we were married?
I know it's not what you deserve, Lenore, but someday...
Oh, you make me sick. I must have been crazy when I married you.
Lenore...
I'm going to say something I've had on my mind for a long time, Alex. Rather than go on this way, I'd prefer to be dead. Look at you. I don't have to put up with you. I'm still young, Alex.
So there it was. Out in the open. An old man with money would have been acceptable. But because I had no money, she was going to leave me. I wanted to plead with her. I would have gotten down on my knees. But before I could say anything, the street door opened. And a man stumbled into the store.
Alex!
Quick, I'm wounded. I helped the man to a chair. He'd been shot in the chest, and the front of his coat was covered with blood. His breathing came hard.
A bullet, my chest. Patch me up.
I'm only a pharmacist. You need a doctor.
I'll call Dr. Johnson.
No, I don't want any doctor. I want you to help me.
Is it because doctors must report bullet wounds? Is that why you want a doctor?
Never mind my reason. I got plenty of dough. I'll give you $500 to take care of me.
Well, I'd better call the police.
No, lady, no. Look, mister, take care of me. Keep it quiet. I'll give you $1,000.
$1,000? Let me see the money.
Here. Here's $1,000 bill. But I got plenty more.
Lenore, help me take him into the back room.
Oh, but Alex...
No, I'll take him myself. You get busy and wipe the blood off the floor.
Oh, no. No, you can't.
Wipe up the blood. Do as I say, Lenore.
What's taking you so long?
I'm looking for a certain medicine among these bottles.
Give me something to stop the bleeding. Hurry.
I'll be ready for you soon. Well, Lenore, did you get the floor clean?
Yes, it's clean. How is he?
He's in bad shape. Weak from loss of blood.
Alex, you haven't done anything for him yet.
Be quiet.
But you've been in here 5 minutes and he's just like he was before. Alex, you're stalling. Alex.
Let him lay there.
But he's dying.
I know.
Alex, call the police.
No.
Are you
going to let him die?
Yes.
But that's as bad as murder.
I didn't shoot him. It's not my fault if he dies. No. He's got money. Thousands of dollars. No one knows he came here. This is our chance, Lenore.
What do you mean?
I'm going to let him die. Take his money, and then get rid of his body. Stay still. I stooped and went through his jacket. There was a wallet containing a few $1 bills and a driver's license, which I handed to Lenore.
His name is James Kirk. He lives in Hillsboro.
His pockets were crammed full of bills of large denominations. Lenore watched, fascinated, as I counted.
How much is it, Alex?
A little over $78,000. We're rich, Lenore.
I'm frightened.
There's nothing to be afraid of. All we have to do now is wait until he dies and get rid of the body.
Do you need me to help you?
No. I can manage alone. This body's heavy. Here. Through the door.
Oh. Alex, he's still alive.
Yes.
What are you going to do now?
It's dangerous to wait here until he dies. Anyway, what difference does it make? He'll be dead when he goes into the water.
No, that's murder.
Call it what you like. We've gone too far now to stop. You wait in the car. I'm going to carry him to the edge of the pier and drop him over the side. Picture a middle-aged druggist committing a perfect crime. But I felt sure that I had done it. For I had Kirk's money, and it seemed that no one could connect his death to me. I rejoined Lenore in the car, started for home. After I'd driven for a few minutes, I noticed she was strangely quiet. What's the matter, dear?
Nothing. Nothing at all.
Something's troubling you. What is it?
Nothing.
You act as though you're afraid of me.
No.
You are afraid of me. But no. Why?
I never saw you act this way before. Something's happened to you. You're different.
Oh, nonsense.
Don't you feel it, Alex? You're a murderer.
Lenore.
You wouldn't even wait until he was dead.
Listen to me, Lenore. Whatever I did for your sake. I wanted the money for you. So you could be happy.
Oh, how can I be happy with this thing hanging over us?
We had breakfast the next morning in absolute silence. Then Lenore went to open the store, while I wrapped the money in a parcel, took it to the bank, placed it in my box in the safe deposit vault. No one paid any attention to me, although the bank was swarming with police detectives. From the bank, I went directly to the drugstore and found a man there waiting.
Sturgis.
Yes?
Biggert is my name. Mark Biggert.
What can I do for you?
I'm an insurance company detective, Mr. Sturgis. I'm investigating the First National Bank robbery for my company. I want you to tell me everything you know about that robbery.
A big man, but not fat, this detective. And although he didn't appear to be very intelligent, he had a look of cunning. His clothes were rumpled, and he rolled an unlit cigar around in his mouth as he spoke.
Suppose you start from the beginning, Sturgis.
There's nothing to talk about, Biggert. I don't know anything about the robbery.
You don't, eh?
No, I don't.
Why should you come here annoying me with silly questions?
I'll tell you why I'm here, Sturgis. And then maybe you'll see your way clear to talk. You know the bank was robbed last night and the crook got away with better than $78,000?
Yes?
The night watchman was shot. He's in a coma now, but before he was shot, he shot one of the crooks.
What does that have to do with me?
I'm coming to you, Sturgis. I'm a slow man, but I'm thorough, which is more than you can say for the harness bulls on the police force. Take those harness bulls. They didn't spot the trail of blood that wounded crook left when he ducked down the alley behind the bank. Funny thing, they clean missed it. But I noticed it, Sturgis. I followed it through the alley and straight up this street. And here's another peculiar thing. The trail ended right smack at the door of this drugstore.
Are you implying...
Two and two makes four, Sturgis. As I said, I'm not a fancy-pants detective, but here's how I figure it. This Yegg was wounded, so he came in here and asked you to fix him up, which you did. In exchange, he gave you a nice big piece of the take to keep your mouth shut. Am I right, Sturgis?
You're 100% wrong.
If you were smart, you'd talk now and save yourself a lot of grief.
I've got nothing to tell you.
Suit yourself, Sturgis. But here's my business card. In case you change your mind, you can reach me, the Hotel Empire. Oh, by the way, the company is offering a $5,000 reward for the return of that money.
I'm not interested. Good day.
Okay. It's your next, Sturgis. I'll be seeing you.
Alex, I heard what he said. He knows.
I should have thought of the blood outside.
Well, how can you stand there and act so calm about it? He knows, I tell you.
Take hold of yourself and know. He only suspects. And his suspicions aren't worth 2 cents unless he can produce evidence. Believe me, we've got nothing to worry about.
Well, I think they do. I think they do have something to worry about. But we'll verify that a little bit later on in the show.
You know,
this
Dale,
isn't a moral.
Yes. Okay.
Oh, go ahead, Dave.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just gonna say, you know, I just think it's not fair, you know, that just because we're 70 years late, that we can't also make a signal limerick that would be read over the radio. It's just not fair.
No, so I know.
I just scratched one out. So let me try this. You guys tell me if you think Signal Gasoline might have gone for this. Here we go.
I'm afraid.
There once was a man from Salina who barely escaped South Carolina. He went to a gas station, had a taco with bacon, and that's how he got Signal Gas.
Wow.
So many opportunities,
Dave.
In that, Dave.
I'm so proud. I'm so proud.
I'm so glad.
I'm nearly weeping.
that had the opportunity of rhyming with so many words we shouldn't use.
Yes. And some we should.
But we can highlight this. We can highlight this one as well, because CW was like, oh, a limerick. So I ran over my man. Why all the fuss? He can still stand. After I hit him number three, it's plain to me I might have dented my van. There you go. That's from CW.
Okay.
She's famous again. There you go.
Yeah. That's a winner.
Oh, Dave, you're a winner, too. There you go. Yeah. Signal Gas.
See? 70 years ago, they would have read my limerick.
They would have.
And they would have bit their lip the entire time.
Yes.
Although it was absolutely spanking clean. I was just waiting for things to drop. But
it was.
Yeah.
Limericks don't have to be dirty. They're just funnier that way. That's all.
I guess. And
I like the
not
ones that
available
make you
for
think
radio.
They're going. I like the ones that make you think they're going down the dark path, and then they really don't.
Well, you mean like when I said Salina?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Exactly.
And Carolina.
Like that.
And Carolina? Salina?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Marginalina? I don't know.
What am I gonna do with you?
We're going to invite him back next week. Do it all again. And tomorrow. Yeah. We need a TARDIS. Why do we need
we
a TARDIS? I wouldn't mind a TARDIS.
Don't we have one?
I want a TARDIS, but so it looks like the Bat Cave on the outside. You go inside and it's just huge. I don't know.
Oh, that'd be kind of cool.
Wouldn't it?
That would be cool.
I'm a Bat guy. I'm a Batman guy, so.
Put a phone booth in the Bat Cave and you got kind of a TARDIS there.
There you go. But then you mix up the thing with Superman. Because he's always... It was so funny in that movie, 1977. He goes to change, and there's no phone booth. There's this little stand thing, and he looks at it up and down. And he keeps walking.
Remember? Yeah. Yep.
That was so funny. As a little kid, I was like, oh, my gosh, you can't find a phone booth. That was just, oh, I love that.
That was a great moment. That was a great movie moment.
Yes. Yes. Oh, I get it. Oh, my. Oh, CW got it. Oh, it took. We need a TARDIS. What round for TARDIS? No, I'm not going there. Anyway. So.
We got a whole lot of radio.
Okay. We got a whole lot of radio. This guy's on. I wanted to say this about it because in the previous little excerpt we had of the 11th hour. Are we doing the 11th? What are we doing?
Yes. Yes.
Wait.
Yes.
It'll be the 11th hour if we get to it. But yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so anyway, this isn't a moral, but never trust a detective that starts off with doing math, you know? Two and two make four here. Yeah, math is bad. You don't want...
Math is bad.
Math is bad.
Oh, so, don't get me started. Yeah. Don't get me started.
Okay, so wait. Now, wait. We're listening to Inner Sanctum Mysteries, right? Yeah, we're trying. Okay,
The first half. Yeah,
sorry.
I have to go.
Yeah, I need to be on the right page because it wouldn't make sense. Okay, yeah. All right, there we go. I only have one page and I'm still confused. Oh, my goodness. All right.
I have a confession.
Hold on, radio there.
We got a lot of radio to go. That's right.
Hold on, radio.
We're wrapping up the confession from Inner Sanctum.
We've got nothing to worry about.
I was cocky then. Too cocky. Lenore was right. I was a changed man. That money had put iron into my spine. And then, that afternoon, I got the first of the phone calls. Hello? Sturgis Drugstore.
This is Western Union calling. I have a telegram for Mr. Alex Sturgis.
This is he speaking.
Will you accept the message over the telephone, Mr. Sturgis?
Yes, of course.
The message reads as follows. Place money in an envelope and mail it to box number 11, General Post Office. Don't fail to act as instructed because your future depends on it.
Is that all?
That's all, Mr. Sturgis. There is no signature.
Thank you. Bye.
Oh, it was bad enough having that detective snooping around, but now this telegram. Oh, don't take any more chances, Alex. Send the money.
No.
Alex, please. I'm frightened.
Listen, Lenore. Calm yourself. It's perfectly clear what happened. One of the bank robbers came with Kirk as far as the store. He must have been frightened away by the police. Now he's using this method to get the money. But he won't get it.
Why? What are you going to do?
I'm going to put a wad of blank paper in an envelope and mail it to that post office box. Then I'll stand watch at the post office and see who claims it.
And then what?
That money means everything to us, Lenore. I've already killed one man for it. If necessary, I'll commit another murder. I placed blank strips of paper in an envelope and mailed the envelope to that post office box. The next morning, I went to the post office and stood near the window, waiting for someone to come along and claim the envelope in box number 11. Hours passed. I got hungry. My legs began to shake from exhaustion. But I couldn't leave that spot. I meant to stay there until...
What are you waiting here for, Sturgis?
A voice cut through my thoughts. I looked up. It was Kelly, the policeman. He was suspicious.
The clerk noticed you hanging around and called for a cop.
It's nothing, Kelly. I arranged to meet my wife here. She's late.
I saw your wife through the drugstore window as I came up the street. You must have forgotten all about your appointment. You'd better get back to the store, Sturgis.
I couldn't stay there after that. I walked around the block. When I came back, the policeman had disappeared. I entered, went to the window, and asked the clerk if anyone had claimed the mail in box 11. He nodded. The letter was gone. My plan to discover the identity of Kirk's confederate had failed. There was nothing to do but go back to the drugstore. It was empty. I felt a sense of danger as soon as I entered. So I closed the street door quietly. Walked as silently as I could to the door of the back room. It was open. Eleanor was at the telephone.
Hello. Hello, Empire? Hotel? Hello. Connect me with Mr. Biggert, please. Yes. Mr. Mark Biggert.
Hang up, Eleanor.
Oh.
Hang up the receiver.
Alex!
You were calling that detective.
Suppose I was. What of it?
You were going to tell him about the money. You were going to double-cross me for the reward.
You're so smart, Alex. What are you going to do about it?
Lenore, don't you understand? I don't want the money for myself. I took it for you. To give you the things that will make you happy.
Big-hearted, unselfish Alex.
What are you laughing at?
I'll tell you why you took that money, Alex. You thought you could buy me with it. Well, you're wrong. I wouldn't stay with you if you had all the money in the world.
Oh, no. Would you leave me after all that's happened?
I'm packing up right now.
No.
You can't stop me.
I love you, Lenore. I did my best to hold you. If I can't have you, no one else will have you.
What do you mean? Alex, stay away from me.
I'm going to kill you, Lenore.
Alex, no. Stop.
I'm going to kill you, my
let
darling.
Let go of my throat. Alex, please, let go.
She's dead. All men kill the thing they love. And I've killed you, Lenore. I felt empty. Drained of all emotion. I buried her body in the cellar of the drugstore. I was even a bit glad that it ended in this fashion. For now, Lenore would be with me forever. Did I say it was ended? I was wrong. I found no peace. For the very next morning, Biggert came to the drugstore.
Morning, Sturgis. Nice morning, isn't it?
What do you want?
Just stopped by to have a chat, Sturgis. Been giving a lot of thought to the First National Bank robbery. You know, that night watchman came out of his coma this morning.
Why tell me about it?
I thought you might be interested. Here's an angle, Sturgis. The watchman says the robbery was pulled by only one man. One single crook, and he was shot. Nice angle, isn't it?
Is it?
Yes, it gave me a new idea, Sturgis. Now, I'm no Sherlock Holmes, but I figure it this way. That crook came in here and asked you to fix him up.
We've gone through this before.
I'm going to take it a little further, Sturgis. The crook asked you to fix him up, but you've got a peek at all that money. So you let him die, took the money, and disposed of the body. How's that for a deal?
Very clever. Can you produce the body?
No, the police haven't been able to locate it, but I'm not discouraged, Sturgis. Those harness bulls aren't very smart. I'll find that body.
And when you do?
I'm an insurance company, Dick Sturgis. I want that $78,000. When I find that body, I'll come around here and you'll cough it up.
I've told you before, I know nothing about that robbery or the money. Now I've got work to do. Suppose you run along.
Okay, Sturgis. So long.
Hello. Sturgis Drugstore.
Western Union calling. I have a telegram for Mr. Alex Sturgis.
This is he speaking. Read it to me, please.
The message reads as follows. Received your letter. Contents not what requested. Suggest you obey instructions. Same box number and post office. This is final.
Is there a signature?
No, sir. There's no signature, Mr. Sturgis.
I hung up. My head was reeling. Out of the confusion in my mind, one thought emerged. The night watchman had said Kirk had no confederates in the bank robbery. Therefore, the person sending me the telegram must be Kirk. The salt water of the bay must have revived him. Kirk was still alive. I found Kirk's wallet on a shelf where Lenore had placed it the night all this began. From the driver's license, I copied his home address. I waited, till after midnight and drove to Hillsboro, where I found Kirk's apartment in an old tenement building. The door was unlocked. I drew out my gun and entered. I meant to kill Kirk. I had to kill him. The living room was empty. No one was in the bedroom. I turned, walked back to the living room.
Drop that gun, Sturgis.
Quick,
drop the gun, quick. I'm not taking any chances with you.
How did you know?
How did I know you were going to come here, Sturgis? Sit down in that chair by the table and I'll tell you.
You sent the telephone?
Yes, I sent them.
You got me to think that Kirk was still alive.
That's right.
And you followed me here. You trailed me.
It's all clear now, isn't it, Sturgis? You take two and two and add it up and it comes out four. Now, where's the money?
The money?
We're going to cut out the cute stuff, Sturgis. I want that money. Now, where is it?
It's in a medicine jar on a shelf in the back room of the drugstore.
All right, let's go, Sturgis. First, you'll give me the money, then I'll take you down to police headquarters.
We drove to the drugstore. I led him into the back room. I knew exactly what I was going to do. On one of the shelves was a bottle of hydrochloric acid. Bigger thought it was the bottle containing the money. I reached up, uncorked the bottle, and flung the burning liquid into his
head. Oh, I'm blind. I'll kill you for this, Sturgis. If I could only see you. Where are you, Sturgis? Sturgis, where are you?
I was huddled against the wall. He stood between me and the door, screaming in pain, firing his gun blindly. The first three shots missed, but the fourth bullet struck me in the stomach. The last thing I remember is Bigot running out of that room shouting for help. I lost consciousness soon after. When I came to, I found myself here in this hospital. You know the rest of the story, Doctor.
That's your confession, eh?
That's my confession.
Did you get all that down on paper, Mr. Bigger?
Got every word of it, Doctor.
Bigger, how did you get here? I thought hydrochloric acid.
You thought you blinded me permanently, but not enough of the stuff get into my eyes to do any real damage.
Lenore.
He's dead, Bigger.
I've seen a lot of funny cases in my time, Doc, but this beats them all. He's a man who commits murder to get a lot of stolen money for his wife. Then he kills his wife, and finally he gets killed himself. And the money? The money is safe and sound in the bank safe deposit vault.
Oh, what a pity. Exit Sturgis. Yes, Bigot smoked him out just like a poor fish. Smoked Sturgis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Host, for a very enjoyable performance of The Confession, tonight's Mystery Playhouse presentation. We'll be hearing from you again in the near future. Creep, until next time, this is Hunter Galloway closing the doors of the Mystery Playhouse and reminding you to sleep tight. Good night. This is the Armed Forces Radio Service.
Very scared.
Very scary.
So much violin.
Yes. As we wrap up Inner Sanctum, show number two. So, if this is show number two, this must be Moro number two. Eerie House Radio proudly presents Gar's Moral of the Story.
Apologies to Garfunkel.
Wherever you are.
Okay, there you go, Garfunkel.
I couldn't hold the old tubes. I'm sorry.
I couldn't. Yeah, well, that happens. You know, I get it. You know. So
hey, you get older. Yeah, it's you know, it's
all right. Yeah. One of the most important elements when making a deathbed confession is the death part.
Yeah. Yep. That's true.
You don't want to make a confession and then live, you know. I'm coming to see Elizabeth. The money's in the. Oh, I feel better. No,
yeah, and the money and the money's gone.
Yeah, and the money's gone. Yeah,
and the money's gone.
Yeah. I feel better. That old Monty Python thing about bring out your dead, bring it. I'm not dead yet. I'm feeling better.
Yeah. That was a classic.
I want to go for a walk.
Yeah.
You're not fooling anyone.
I'm happy.
You're not fooling.
I'm happy.
I'm so happy. I'm so happy. Oh, so much fun. So much fun. We have a whole lot of radio.
That's what I understand.
Yeah. We're into... Oh, did I? I think I did. Oh, wrong mouse. See, you guys are in double trouble. There are two keyboards in front of me. Two keyboards and two mices, and I'm trying to figure it out.
Yeah,
oh, wait,
but
oh.
I got the one that counts.
You do. So the 11th Hour was a South African thriller suspense series with occasional science fiction plots. Dated back as early as 1941. There's another date knocking it up to 1946. So it had a long run.
Here's a little bit on
Springbok Radio, which was so big in radio drama, because you got to remember that they didn't really have television in South Africa until the 1970s. So here it is. This was a letter or a memo that was written from a guy who says, I am a South African, and I remember The Creaking Door, which aired on Springbok Radio beginning in the 50s, and as I recall, very well. My brother, who was nearly 6 years older than I am, would switch on the radio in the room we shared and listen. I was so scared out of my wits. Of course, he would listen in the dark while we should have been sleeping. I would immediately jump into his bed and hold on to him tightly. I have 25 episodes, but unfortunately, the South African Broadcasting Corporation in those days never archived any of their productions and soon taped over them. So only what was recorded was by fans that remains today. That's kind of how we got to hear all these CBS Radio Mystery Theaters the same way. Springbok continued until the early 80s and aired a lot of local drama. It was only on January 6, 1976 that television came to this country. So our radio drama by that time was very sophisticated. It was very sad for us to witness the eventual demise of the station. So it was oriented to drama that there was no way it was going to make the transition to more modern form of radio, as there were already such stations in existence. My father never really made the adjustment to television, remained a radio listener until his death in August of 1976.
And here with a traffic report is Gar.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
It's mighty hot out here.
There's a little hiss back there. It sounds like you're outside playing in traffic or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a hiss.
It went away. It went away. There was
it's
a little
gone.
Hiss.
It's gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now I don't know where my hiss is.
Well, don't have a hiss either.
The entire show and everything went dead for me, so I called back.
We have just enough time to wrap this baby up. Let's get to
let's get in.
The 11th hour.
In there with the 11th hour. Dave, have we heard this a program on I believe we have in the past on Erie House.
We've heard a couple shows. I don't know that we've heard in 11th hour or not, but we can check that out in between segments here.
We're going to hear one now. It's called A Curious Confession, and it's from?
February 27th, 1946. Where'd I get that number?
I have no idea.
Time, the silent herald of life and death, success or failure. The unseen force that measures man's destiny, reaching its most fateful moment as it slowly strikes the 11th hour. The judge was bored, the jury listless. The courtroom, hot and airless that July afternoon, as the voice of the prosecutor droned on, reading out Edward Brown's confession of murder. The defense had made no effort to keep that confession from being admitted as evidence, so the trial was as good as over. Eddie Brown would hang. In the press gallery, I hadn't bothered making shorthand notes. I'd heard Eddie's confession before. He had, in fact, made it first to me. In the dock, the prisoner betrayed no sign that he was soon to drop a bomb and turn his trial into one of the most sensational I'd ever witnessed. No, Eddie's handsome 23-year-old face showed nothing. He listened impassively as Mr. Cecil Pollock, Crown Prosecutor, read the statement he had so willingly signed.
Attention to this passage. The prisoner says, the Soho shop was untenanted. I had been engaged by the owners to repaint the front of the building. They had given me the keys so I could change inside and store my paint and ladders in the back room. I stopped work early and was standing in front of the shop, killing time and looking at the passers-by, when a girl came down the street. She was wearing a summer frock and carrying a large handbag. She stopped and looked me over carefully. Then she opened her handbag, took out a packet of American cigarettes, and came over to me.
Hiya, Buster.
Hi.
You got a match, or do I have to use my own?
Sorry. A match is in the back room in my other clothes.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, what do you know? I haven't got a match in my purse of that.
Oh, if you wait a second, I'll get you one.
No hurry. That isn't why I stopped.
No?
No. Oh, look, I know this sounds kind of funny, but it isn't, see? I'm American. I've just been divorced. I got quite a nice little settlement out of the chump I was married to. And me and my girlfriend, Mabel, we decided to take a little trip.
Yeah.
Well, we came to London, first on account of you people understand American, even if you don't speak it. Well, we've been sitting up in our hotel room for 3 days, and not one man has spoken to us or even given us the eye. I don't know whether we've got the plague or they're just stuck up.
Well, anyway,
I told Mabel I was sick of it. I was going out in the street and speak to the first good-looking man I saw and make him a proposition.
A proposition?
Oh, look, Buster, the kind of places we want to see in this town you can't get into without a man. Oh, we got plenty of dough. We'll pay for everything and give you something for your time. We want a guide, see? Well, how about it?
I don't know. Guide's one thing, a jiggler is another.
You're right, Buster. Make no mistake about it. What we want is a guide.
Yeah. Well, tell you what we'll do. Come inside. We'll have a cigarette and talk it over.
Oh, okay. Oh, gosh, it's kind of dark in here with a blind pole.
All right. Give me a hand. I'll lead the way.
Maybe we should leave the door open.
Oh, don't be silly. Give me a hand.
In the following passage, the prisoner clearly states his motive. He says, while the girl, who subsequently identified herself as Juanita Bell, was rummaging in her purse for a match, I had seen a large roll of banknotes. In the back room, I tried to take the purse from her. She struggled and began to scream. I put my hands around her throat in an effort to silence her. I lost control and forgot the strength of my hands. The next thing I remember, she was lying slumped on the floor, dead. I ran out of the shop. I was so agitated by what I had done that I forgot to lock the door. Later, I threw the key into the Thames. I wandered around aimlessly, trying to think what to do. Finally, I went back to my rooming house and hurriedly began to pack, intending to run away. There was a knock at the door. I was half out of my mind with fear.
Who's there?
Inspector Clark, Scotland Yard. I'd like to talk to you, Mr. Brown.
Just a minute. I'm shaving.
Going somewhere, Mr. Brown?
No. I'm unpacking, as a matter of fact. I'm not going anywhere.
Oh, but you are, Mr. Brown. We'd like to have a word with you down at the yard. I understand you have the keys to a vacant shop in Soho.
Keys? Why, I did have them. I don't have them now. I gave them to a chap late this afternoon.
Oh? Who was this chap?
Well, he said he was a prospective tenant. Said he just wanted to look round. And the owners had told him to get the keys from me. I gave them to him and left before he did.
Can you describe this man?
Oh, he was just a man. Medium height, ordinary sort of face. Nothing very special about him.
I see. You can't tell us anything that would help us to identify him.
Yes. He was wearing a leather coat. A long leather coat like German officers wore.
I doubt that'll help us very much. A lot of soldiers brought those back from Germany after the war.
Oh, yes, I suppose they did.
Would you recognize this man again?
Yes, I think so.
Well, now, suppose you come along with me, Mr. Brown.
What for?
Just to help us, a little information and so forth. Good morning, Mr. Brown. Sleep well?
No, I didn't. You had no right to keep me here all night.
Sorry, but we thought it was necessary. Now, this shouldn't take very long. All right, Sergeant. You can start the men through the lineup now.
Walk out on the platform and stand facing the inspector. Turn sideways, showing your profile. Then go off the other side. All right, let's go now.
Look closely now. See if you recognize the man you gave the key to.
All right, Inspector.
You have no right to put me in a lineup. I haven't done anything.
That's him. That's the man in the leather coat.
What have I done? Who are you? What are you accusing me of?
That's the man I gave the key to. He killed her, Inspector. He killed her.
The prisoner's confession continues as follows. When the man I had falsely identified as the one to whom I had given the key was able to prove his whereabouts at the time of the murder, the inspector again turned his attention to me. Again and again I was questioned, but I stuck to my original statement that I had given my key to a man in a leather coat. After several days, I was released, for the police could not prove enough against me to bring me to trial. Over the next 2 years, I brooded about what I had done. In November of 1948, I went to the offices of a large London newspaper and asked to see Mr. Kent Rogers, the court reporter. I had often read his accounts of trials in the press.
Mr. Rogers?
Yes. What's on your mind?
I want to confess to a murder.
You... would you mind saying that again?
2 years ago, I strangled an American girl named Juanita Bell. The police couldn't prove I did it, so they released me.
Mr. Bell, if you're some kind of a crank trying to get publicity...
I'm not a crank. I can tell you exactly how I did it. Everything.
Yes, well, why tell me? Why don't you go to the police?
I like the way you write up trials in the newspaper. Got a nice style. Anyway, why are you complaining? It's a scoop for you, isn't it?
Yes, yes. If it's true.
It's true, all right. Besides, I got another reason for telling you.
What reason?
Never mind. You just take down what I say. Then you can check with Inspector Clark at Scotland Yard. He handled the case before.
My lad, gentlemen of the jury. The prisoner, Edward Brown, stands convicted of murder out of his own mouth by his own voluntary statement. Therefore, the Crown need present no further evidence. And on these words, his own words, the Crown rests its case.
Thank you.
Is counsel for the defense now ready to present his case?
Yes, my lord.
You may proceed, Mr. Sands.
Thank you. Gentlemen of the jury, in order to save the court's time, I will waive the customary opening remarks usually made by defense counsel. I will call my first and only witness, the defendant, Edward Brown.
We were surprised that the defense had decided to call the prisoner. There was a stir of interest in the court, but no sympathy crossed the faces of the jurors as Eddie Brown took the stand.
And now then, Mr. Brown, you have heard the statement read out in this court.
I have.
Is it the truth?
It's an absolute lie. Silence in court.
Mr. Brown, do I understand that you repudiate your confession?
No, my lad. I said those things and signed my name to them. But they're all lies. I never saw Juanita Bell in my life. I gave the key to the shop to the man in the leather coat, just as I told the inspector at first.
You may proceed with your examination, Mr. Sands.
Thank you, my lad. Your confession is entirely false?
It is.
Yet you voluntarily made the statement to the police, and you made the same statement to the court reporter, Kent Rogers.
I did.
I see. Then tell me, why did you go to Rogers' office at the newspaper and tell him this story if it were not true?
For 2 years, I lived under suspicion. No one would employ me. My friends wouldn't associate with me. Yet no charge had ever been laid against me. Therefore, I had no hope of ever clearing my name. I decided to confess so that I'd have to be brought to trial. That's why I told Mr. Rogers this story. That's why I'm here. To clear my name.
Mr. Pollock.
Yes, sir.
In your closing remarks to the court, I understood you to say that you intend to offer no evidence other than the prisoner's confession. Is that correct?
Yes, my lad.
I see. Gentlemen of the jury, it is obvious that the defendant is a liar. But it is, of course, equally obvious that he cannot be convicted because of it.
Hey, let's see what the happens to this guy, if he's going to get it or not.
Well, you know, when you're that good of a liar, you never know.
Yes. There's always a future in law.
It struck me funny. If you go back and rewind this in your head and then twist it around to let Monty Python's group of actors do this, this would be hilarious.
I could see it. I could see it.
Yeah, I was sitting there and I was like, wait, you know, if they got John Cleese and Eric Idle and all the rest in there, this would be a hoot. This man is a liar. it would be really unusual.
Ripe for good comedic opportunity.
Yes. That's a twisted mind of Gar. That's where I go. Monty Python would make this so funny.
Yeah, we think of a trial and a confession, and Gar thinks to Monty Python. There you go.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
Call in the Spanish Inquisition. We'll make them confess.
That's it.
Wait. I was thinking
no
of the Spanish expects. Inquisition.
No one expects the Spanish Inquisition. I love that. We're having a whole lot of Monty Python moments here tonight. I don't know.
We can do Mel Brooks, The Inquisition. What a show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The Inquisition. Here we go.
Oh, yes.
Oh, there'll never
CW's
be another
into
Mel
it.
Brooks. There'll never
yep.
be another Mel Brooks.
Wait. Did he pass? Did he pass?
No.
He didn't pass yet. No.
No.
Not yet.
No, his close friend did. Reiner.
Yes.
Carl Reiner
did, yes.
Which reminds me, it is time for an Erie House Radio bit of financial advice.
Okay.
It is prudent when purchasing a birthday card for a 100-year-old to wait until the last minute.
Yeah, absolutely.
Save a stamp. I don't know.
There's Dale K. moral, for what it's worth.
Okay. Well, when I'm 100, I'm going to be sitting there, like, where's that letter from Dale, darn it? You know.
I'm just waiting.
Yeah.
And,
dude, when you're
100, if you're
100, I'll be 105. I won't even know my own name.
Yep. When you get turn 100, you get the abbreviated version of happy birthday.
Yeah. Like, get off my porch. You know, I don't know what that would be.
No. The abbreviated version, I think, means hurry up while he's here to celebrate.
Open your card before you blow out the candles, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Somebody get the fire extinguisher.
Exactly.
You don't want to buy too exciting of a gift either.
Well, that's true. Yeah, you have to be careful. Although some people have said that they claim that their longevity is due to booze and cigarettes. I don't know.
I haven't heard that.
That's a great prescription.
Yeah.
No, George, was it George Burns? He was like cigars, a well-made drink, and women. It was something along that line.
He actually took a lot of naps. What the heck?
I remember him being interviewed, and they says, well, you know, he always talked about women. And they said, with your love of women, how come you didn't have a lot of kids? He said, I even take my cigar out of my mouth once in a while.
The heck does that mean? Okay,
you
I'm
think
lost,
it over.
Okay.
You think it over.
No. I'll let Monty Python do it. I don't know. Maybe it'll
make more sense to you that way.
There you go.
Yes, Monty Python
I'm
it up.
I'm slow. Yes.
No, you're not slow.
The 11th hour. Did you guys hear what I said, or did it cut out? Because I said a whole bunch about the 11th hour.
You did.
No? I did.
Yeah,
you heard that?
Yeah. And by the way, Dale, I did check the spreadsheet. We have not shown or played 11th hour before tonight.
Ah, so this one's new to the program. This is the 11th hour with a curious confession. Let's wrap it up. And then we'll be back for more fun.
Edward Brown, a self-confessed murderer, left the court a free man. The case of the curious confession would have ended up another of London's unsolved crimes, except for a strange course of events in which I was again to figure in my capacity as court reporter. It was almost 2 years later that I dropped into Scotland Yard late one afternoon to call on Inspector Clark.
Well, Rogers, haven't seen you for several weeks.
You haven't been in court lately?
No, I haven't. The way things are going, I may never get my present case to court. What's on your mind?
Yeah, well, I'm doing a spot of crime reporting at the moment.
Yeah, is there a change as good as a holiday?
Well, I go a bit stale on court reporting. Like to get out among my raw material occasionally, see the people I write about before they appear in court. I'm covering the case you're working on now, the Silk Stocking murder.
You press chaps glamorize everything, sir. That stocking wasn't silk. It was lisle. And the murdered woman was not young and beautiful as she was written up. She was over 40. And she looked it.
Yes. We do color the facts a little sometimes. After all, a lisle stocking suggests, a housemaid. We couldn't call the case that, the lisle stocking murder. It's not, euphonious, more glamorous.
Mm. You know the details, I suppose?
No, more or less, yes. But I'd like to hear them from you, just for the record.
Mary Sutton, bookkeeper, unmarried, had a basement flat in Victoria. During the night, somebody entered her flat with the intention of robbing her. She was in bed. She evidently awakened. The burglar grabbed the first thing handy, her stocking, and then strangled her with it. He then took what money he could find and left the flat. She was discovered the next morning by neighbors who had heard nothing at all during the night.
Any clues?
None. Sometimes, though, you get a break in the sort of case. At least that's what I've been telling myself. Come in.
There's a young woman outside who wants to see you, Inspector.
What about?
An RAF deserter.
Well, can't you handle it, Sergeant?
Well, yes, sir, but she's read about you in the paper, and she says talking to you will be more like talking to someone she knows.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
The penalty of fame, eh?
And who's responsible? You reporters. All right, Sergeant, send her in.
Yes, sir.
Oh, you want me to step outside?
No, you can stay. I'll just have a word with her then, and I'll pass her on to the sergeant.
You can go right in, Miss Caulfield.
Thank you.
Come in, miss.
Thank you. I'm Laura Caulfield, Inspector.
How do you do? This is Mr. Rogers.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Please sit down. Now then, miss, what's troubling you?
Well, it's about me young man. Or rather, he was me young man up until a few weeks ago. He had a few too many at the pub one evening, and he told me he was a deserter from the RAF. Well, naturally, I refused to see him after that. But he kept coming round and, well, threatening me. Well, I don't like it about his being a deserter, but I wouldn't put him in. I mean, I hate doing a thing like this. Only, you see, I'm afraid.
Afraid? Afraid of what?
Well, every night he comes and stands across the street and watches me window. If I go out, he stops me and we argue. Last night he was really wild. He hinted that he'd taken care of other girls who tried to throw him over and... Well, I'm afraid of him. I really am.
Yeah. Well, you're perfectly right in coming along to us. In fact, it'd be wrong of you if you hadn't come. Could have meant trouble for you.
That's what I thought.
You just go outside, tell all this to the sergeant, will you? Give me a name and address, and he'll arrange to have the young man picked up.
Oh, yes, sir. Look, I brought this along so you'd know him when you see him. It's a snap we had taken right after we first met. Here it is.
Oh, thank you. This will be quite a big help to us. Rogers.
Yes, Inspector.
Take a look at this. Do you recognize him?
He does look a bit familiar, yes, but... No, can't say that I do.
When you last saw him, he had no moustache, and he looked much younger. He had very much longer hair, not short cropped like this.
Yes, of course.
Inspector.
Now, you just run along, miss, and tell the sergeant all about it. We'll take care of everything.
Oh, well, all right, Inspector. Thanks very much.
Oh, miss, will you ask the sergeant just to step in here for a moment?
Yes, sir.
See, that's a photo of Eddie Brown.
Yeah, that's him, all right.
Always wondered what happened to him.
A young lady says you want to see me, sir.
Yes, keep her here while I go out and pick up her boyfriend.
But I thought you weren't going to handle it.
I've changed my mind. Have a car sent round. I shall be leaving at once.
All right, Inspector.
I'd like to go with you to pick him up.
I'm sure you would. Unfortunately, regulations won't quite permit that. Drop round in the morning. I'll let you have the story then. It'll be interesting to see Eddie Brown again.
Inspector, the sergeant tells me you picked up Brown last night.
He certainly did.
Anything in it for me?
One of the best stories you've ever struck. But you can't print it.
Oh. You know, why not,
Eddie Brown confessed to the silk stocking murder.
He what?
You heard me. He confessed to the murder of Mary Sutton. Just like he did in the Juanita Bell case.
I say, this is getting a bit of a habit, isn't
it? You can say that again. His case beginning to follow an all-too-familiar pattern. He got away with it once, and he might do so again.
You don't mean it.
I'm afraid I do. You can't print that he's been tried for murder before, nor can that fact be introduced as evidence at his trial.
No, that's true.
It's a fundamental tenet of British law. The jury can't be told of a defendant's previous conviction or trial.
Let me see him, Inspector. Maybe I can...
Yeah, you'll see him, all right. You'll see him in court.
And so, incredible as it seems, I again took my place in the press gallery and looked down at Edward Brown, for the second time a prisoner in the dock. As the Crown Prosecutor read out Brown's confession, only three people in the courtroom realized that his earlier trial was being reenacted in an amazing fashion. So changed was Brown's appearance that few had recognized him, and so common was the name that it had gone, well, I'd say unnoticed. But fate had decreed another remarkable coincidence. The Crown Prosecutor who rose to read out his confession was the same who had faced him before, Mr. Cecil Pollock. His presence in court must have given the defendant a shock.
Continues as follows.
Mr. Pollock paused, took a sip of water, and continued reading Brown's statement.
For several weeks, I had been hiding out during the day in a basement cupboard across from Mary Sutton's flat. The door of the building was never locked, and I was able to go in and out at will. On the night of October the 7th, I entered Mary Sutton's flat. She was asleep, but in the light of a street lamp outside, I could see her purse lying on a table beside her bed. I crept over and was about to take the purse when she awakened and began to scream. We struggled. Somehow, I managed to get a stocking round her throat. I choked her with that. Then I took the money in her purse and left the flat. 3 days later, I was arrested by the police as a deserter from the RAF, at which time I made this voluntary statement. Signed, Edward Brown.
Step by step, the trial progressed with its incredibly familiar pattern. As his first witness, the prisoner's counsel, Mr. R.G. Williams, called Edward Brown to the stand.
You have heard your statement read out by the learned prosecutor?
I have.
Is there any comment you wish to make on it?
Yes. I did not kill Mary Sutton.
Does counsel for the defense intend to claim that the confession was expected under duress?
No, my lad. We claim that for reasons which the defendant will explain, he did not tell the truth in his statement.
If the Crown wishes to move for an adjournment, I will hear such a motion.
The Crown does not require an adjournment, my lad. We are prepared this time.
My lad, I object. I move the prosecutor's final remark be deleted from the record.
I withdraw the remark, my lad.
If the jury will disregard the prosecutor's remark, we are prepared this time. Counsel for the defense may proceed with examination.
Mr. Brown, do you deny all of your statement to the police?
No, sir. I am a deserter from the RAF. I didn't enter the Sutton flat on the night of the murder, but I did it because I heard a struggle inside. Then a man ran out of the door and ran up the steps. I went in to see what was wrong. I found her dead. I was about to leave when suddenly I decided to confess to the murder.
Why?
I was despondent. I didn't want to go on living. I was a deserter. Couldn't find a job. I was desperately in love with my girl, Laura Caulfield. And she had turned me over. Sooner or later, I knew I'd be caught and probably convicted of the Sutton murder anyway. But who'd believe I hadn't done it? And when my girlfriend turned me into the police, I confessed to a murder I did not commit.
No more questions, my lad.
You may proceed with cross-examination, Mr. Pollock.
Thank you, my lad. Mr. Brown, you wished to confess to a murder you did not commit.
Yes, sir.
You decided that while you were in the room?
Yes, sir.
I see. If you wished to confess, why didn't you go directly to the police and do so?
Well, I guess I decided later.
That is not what you said a moment ago.
Now that I think it over, I decided later, yes.
I see. Did you touch the body?
No, sir.
Did you touch the stocking?
No, sir.
But you saw it in the light thrown by the street lamp outside.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Brown, will you describe the stocking?
It was just an ordinary Lyle stocking, nothing special about it.
An ordinary Lyle stocking?
Yes.
Mr. Brown, are you aware that in all newspaper accounts of this case, it has been referred to as the silk stocking murder? You could not possibly know it was Lyle unless you had committed the murder yourself.
No, I read it somewhere. Why, I heard...
I submit that your entire confession is true. That you murdered Mary Sutton exactly as you said you did. That you are guilty. Guilty of murder as charged.
The jury was out 40 minutes. Then they returned a verdict of guilty. The man who confessed once too often was convicted and later hanged. What curious compulsion made Edward Brown confess? Evidently some twisted bravado drove him to crave center stage in the drama of the courtroom. Though it took 5 years and 2 trials to accomplish it, justice was finally done. And Edward Brown paid for his crimes with his life. In his case, there was no reprieve in the 11th hour.
Listening for another mounting drama of action and suspense when we again bring you the 11th hour. The Case of a Curious Confession was written by Philip Albright and produced by Jim Bradley for our Transa.
And a great ending to that one.
Yep. Yes, it was.
Uh-huh.
Yep, yep. But I bet you there's even more to it than that.
Well, it could be if I scrolled a little faster. Eerie House Radio proudly presents Scar's Moral of the Story.
A court case with no case still has its day in court.
Show starts in 2 minutes.
Here you go.
Does it?
Yes, it does.
Apologies to Gilbert Gottfried. Okay, yeah, there we go.
A confusing soundbite is better than no soundbite at all. True or false?
True.
True?
I don't know. I don't know. I was hoping you guys could tell me.
While we were listening to that, again, I don't know what it is. Today is just a Monty Python day. They went back to court the second time, and all of a sudden I heard as a judge saying, objection here, objection there, and that nice policeman giving his evidence so well, beautifully speaking voice. But after a bit, all I could do was bang my gavel. Bang my gavel, which is from Monty Python. The Poofy Judge, if you remember that.
Yeah.
Bang my gavel. I bang my gavel.
A whole lot of radio have been done tonight, and that gives us some time to shamelessly self-promote. Dave, you've got a big premiere coming up, don't you?
Yep. Sunday night, I invite everybody, I'll invite you tomorrow too, to a Facebook Live event, 7 p.m., where we're showing off our 100th Weirdness Really Bad Movie episode. I have 28 cast members that came together to make that episode happen.
Hey, and we're going to be live in chat.
We'll be live in chat, absolutely. Yep.
Live in chat.
So,
And tons of skits and fun stuff.
Tons of skits. Tons of skits.
This Sunday.
This Sunday. Sunday.
7 p.m.
And 7 p.m. There we go. And that's
go. I think we have
6 p.m. standard. No.
I think we have another selfless, shameless promotion to happen right here.
Yeah,
tomorrow.
We're coming up with our 500th show pretty soon. No.
we're going to be doing our 926th show next Tuesday. I hope everybody tunes in. No, I don't know. What are you guys talking about?
You got something going on at 8 o'clock tomorrow night, Gar?
I'm a little tentative on this one. I want to say yes, that tomorrow at 8 p.m. Eastern time that horrible horror will happen, but I'm bringing a new computer up, and it's slow going. So I don't know.
But that would only be after tomorrow's
that's
offerings.
True.
We're continuing with confessing with more mysteries.
You're right. We're confessing to some mysteries tomorrow night. Yes, we are.
Yeah, with Mr. and Mrs. North and Barry Craig. So there you go. Two great stories tomorrow night. As we wrap up Confession Weekend.
Wrap it up. When was Easter? Was last weekend, right?
Yes, that's correct. That is correct,
yes.
Sir.
I'm not really too aware of stuff. Do people confess on Easter?
You have to confess before you can receive the sacraments. Okay?
And the sacraments being jelly beans?
No.
Yes. Yeah.
No. Yeah. 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 And a chocolate Easter bunny?
No, they're like little wafers.
Wafers! Oh, the flesh thing.
Yeah.
And blood thing. Yeah, that. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what they put me through all that as a kid. It was fun.
Who was that? Oh, was that Carlin? Was that George Carlin? No, who was that? Maybe it was Sam Kinison. Somebody did it, and it was like, oh. Yeah, that was rough.
probably Kinison. He was rough like that. He was rough on religious
stuff. He was actually an evangelical person
on
the stage doing it.
Yes, he was.
And then he moved to comedy.
He had the right style for his type of humor, which was, of course, very loud and sometimes abrasive. Well, okay, he was always abrasive, but that was his show.
Yes.
That was his gig.
Did you enjoy any of his presentations? I will confess that I did.
I found him hilarious.
I did.
Definitely not for kids. But
right.
My gosh, he was a clever comic in his weird way.
I want my records back. I want my records back. Oh boy. Oh, so much
the
fun.
Record.
See, and you can do that. That was there was this one thing about he sang the song.
Make it quick.
Okay. And he was playing piano very, very wonderfully, and he started singing the song about a breakup that he just suffered with this lady, and the end of it was, I want my records back. I want my records back. And it was very funny.
Okay.
And very clean what I did. Okay. There you go. I
want to thank everyone for stopping in tonight. Nice crowd. Linda Lou, Fogs Bay, GGSI Paper, Rob Smith, and, of course, Secret Squirrel, who couldn't stick around. Thanks for listening live. Hope you join us tomorrow night for some more of this fun and two more radio shows. We will see you later. We'll be back at 6:30 tomorrow. Good luck in
Pittsburgh.
I did.
I didn't. No.
Vandenberg out, Vincent.
Vincent.
Passing lights are growing dim. There's no one left but me and him.
And that
when next we meet in Frankenstone, don't come alone.
Who would come alone?
There. Had to get that candle out. Now I got to spit on my microphone. Oh, you.
There's a YouTube video shows you how to clean your mic after you spit on it.
There's a video for everything on YouTube.
There is. There's way too many.
You want to rotate change your brakes? All right, let's show you how to do that.
Yeah. I actually had to do this last night. Are we off? What are we doing?
No,
are we in the
after?
Yeah.
We're boring everyone with this. Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, Gar had to get elbows deep into a computer last night, and I tore it apart, and it was dead on the table. And I had to go to a YouTube video to go, what's wrong here? I just had a weird plight. And you guys might get a kick out of this because it's kind of funny. So, like maybe 6 months ago, I'm guessing, might be 10, I bought 3 power supplies and 3 really expensive video cards for computers. Mm-hmm. And so I installed the power supply on one of these boxes, and I put in the graphic card in there, and it's just chugging along and working crazy, you know, and everything. But I need to modify and go to a newer one. So I get the power supply, and I go and I put it in there, and I'm like, wait a second, what is this? They have this new little teeny doodad that works as the CD player. And it's got this weird plug, and it's not on my brand new power supply. You know, so I'd have to buy an adapter maybe. So I'm like, yep. I don't know what to do. And I'm looking on YouTube, and I can't figure it out. I called Dell because I've got protection and support for this computer for the next 2 years. I called them, and they go, oh, you can't use a power supply unless it says Dell on it. And I was like, but. And he said, where did you get this power supply? And that's when the memory thing kicked in. I have no idea who told me or where I got the knowledge to buy these power supplies or buy these graphic cards. They fit. They work. But I can't remember the source. I'm like, I didn't choose them willy-nilly, you know. It's like, I don't know. It's just bizarre. So I'm trapped in my own brain.
There. frightening concept.
I ended up putting the power supply that originally came with the unit back in there, and I went ahead and put the new graphics card in there, and plugged it in, and it works. I'm able to put things together, do the computers and stuff, but I'm stymied on why I got those power supplies. That's crazy. They're supposed to be Dell compatible, and I don't know where I got the info. No idea. I'm lost. Hmm. Weird. Memory. It's a good thing.
Sometimes.
If you can recall where you put it.
Yeah. Well, see, everything gets mixed up with me. I've talked with you and I've talked with Dave about this. That pretty much everything happened 2 weeks ago, you know. Oh, I fell down. I broke my hip. When that happened? Oh, about 2 weeks ago. I don't know. Bought a new car. Oh, really? When did you do that? Oh, about 2 weeks ago. I don't know. Yeah. It all muddles together, and I have no chronology anymore.
I woke
anymore.
Up. It was in the driveway.
I woke up. It was there. I was like, well, maybe, you know, 2 weeks ago. I don't know. Where did that come from? You know? I don't know. Just crazy. Any of you guys ever I just confessed that I really, really enjoyed Sam Kinison. Once you get past the abusiveness of Sam Kinison, funny stuff. When I first heard it, I was like, oh, this is too abrasive for my kind soul, but
he did this one series where he was a conscience on Fox and early Fox television. He was a guy's conscience, which made
you know
it
whose
that much
conscience
funnier.
He was. You know whose conscience Ooh. He was. Al Bundy's. It's a Wonderful Life. And Al Bundy and Sam Kinison comes down and goes, "You think your life is bad? Uh-oh. And away, she had and grew a new chin every year we were married. We had two kids. She ate them. I don't know." And
it was great.
It was great. And Al's
series.
Like, "Oh, my God, this is my guardian angel." No.
Yeah. Well, I remember he was in that vehicle with that other comedian. I get no respect, that guy.
Rodney Dangerfield. Yeah.
Rodney, yeah, he was in that. And he was like in a class. And the guy, Rodney, was talking about the Vietnam War. And Sam is like in the front row. He was like, "I'll tell you about the Vietnam War." Rah, rah, rah. And just, he went on and on and on. And it was,
yeah.
I forgot his name already. I get no respect. Rodney Dangerfield. There we go.
Yeah.
He was like, "Now that's what I'm talking about." It was just it's hilarious. And even George Carlin. George Carlin started out as a very clean comic, and he was on the Ed Sullivan Show, and he was on Carson.
Oh, yeah.
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 Yeah. On the hippy dippy weather, man.
And he did, you know, a whole bunch. But in his later career, he got very harsh. He was pointing out the things, and maybe it was because society was changing too, if you think about that, you know. So many things, so, you know, I was kind of stunned, because he was kind of my comedian hero growing up. He was always, I always had his stuff, yeah, so every once in a while, I definitely enjoy unusual comedy like Carlin and Kinison and Monty Python. Oh my gosh, they were ribald before it was correct. It was just hilarious. Did you guys
the
see
series
it?
I was going to say, the series I was thinking about was Charlie Hoover, and he was the Tim Matheson's inside voice. It only lasted 7 episodes. Which is amazing, because it was on Fox. I thought you had to kill somebody to get off Fox.
Yeah.
Well, you do, but you got to hide the body really well. That's, you know.
That's the important part, yes.
Yeah, and so what you do is you find endangered flowers, and you plant the body under there, because nobody's going to dig that up. You know, it's like, you know, "Oh, don't touch those are endangered." But it looks like a body's under there. Ah, don't worry about it.
Evidence Tampering 101 by Gar the Ghoul.
Woohoo!
We do not recommend you try this at home.
No, and don't bury anyone at sea.
Yeah.
Unless you have their permission.
Well, unless you have a lot of heavy rocks, that's important.
Yeah, that too. Yeah.
You got to have heavy rocks.
They planted that guy in the ocean, and they said Australia, I think. Am I wrong? Didn't they say they were going to plant him? They were going to bury him at sea.
Yeah.
In the waters
of Australia. I was just outside
which
of
is
Australia,
known
yeah.
for sharks. Known for sharks, big time. You know, so, you know, talk about being fish food. Well, there you go.
You'll be swimming with the fishies after the sharks get you.
And there's a weird thing. Okay, in movies I've seen this, where they have the guy who's getting buried at sea, and they put him in the box, and they go, and then they're done with that. And they get ready to bury him at sea, and they just tip the box open, and the end opens up, and he slides out like a mummy. You know?
Yeah.
Okay. So are they shaving on coffins? What are they doing with that? You know, why not, you know, toss the coffin in there, too? He paid for it.
Bill Cosby had a bit on that, too. He thought they felt ripped off. And so, you know, as they were getting rigor mortis, he had them grab onto the flag. And then when they tried to open him up, and they goes, what, let go of that thing. He says, "Hey, man, he loves his flag. He wants to go down with it."
Mm-hmm.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, you could do all... Well, no, now we're getting really dark. Anyway.
Perfect.
Go down that rabbit...
It is eerie house.
That
now.
Rabbit hole. It is eerie house, but yeah. How dark are we going to go? I've been to one. I think I've been to one funeral in my life. One? Is that it? Yeah, apparently I don't go to these things, or I don't know anybody. One of the two.
Oh, you'll go to at least one more.
Oh, at least one more. Yeah. Well, it'll be powdery, so I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's one more to go.
Yeah, one more.
One more to go. Yeah, wow. Oh,
don't have to drag me in. Don't have to drag me in, but I'll go to one more.
Yeah, none of my parents. I forgot. None of my parents had a funeral. They did the dusty thing, you know. They turned to dust, and then, you know, nobody went hibbity, but how you hibbity hibbity. Did you, Dale? Are you? I can't even remember your name. Dale, do you remember? do you remember a movie called Wizards? By
Ralph
Bakshi.
Yeah, Ralph Bakshi, who did some of the early Spider-Man cartoons. Yes.
Yes, that guy. And
no,
do you remember the part
him.
Where? Never, me neither. I got nothing. I forget. Do you remember the part where the two soldiers go, "Hey, we got these people over in the church over here. We need to figure out what we're going to do. Do we kill them? Do we not? What do you want to do?" To these religious leaders. And these guys sit there in a tent, and they go, "Ah, they smack each other with boards and all
that."
Well, I, you know, I don't want to get what is that word? I can't remember the word anyway. It's a good thing I don't have Tourette's because it would come in handy right about
close
now.
Close enough.
Close. So there you go. What is? You don't choose. I can't remember. How you doing, Dave?
I'm doing fine, sir. Thank you.
Did you ever confess anything, Dave?
Only when I'm forced.
See, you got to do something in order. Only when you're caught. Well, maybe, you know.
It's generally a little too late when you've been caught.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
To confess.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But to have a full impact after you've been caught, not so impressive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then when you get caught, you don't get time. And then when you get caught, you also don't get time off for good behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think the problem is you have to do something in order to confess, and I don't think Dave's our character.
Yeah, that's true. What has he got to confess?
Except overworking. I definitely
there's
overworking.
That.
You can confess to that a few times.
But I always have time for you guys, you know.
Yes. If it were a crime, you'd get the chair.
I tell you.
Yeah, I could use a new chair, too. Thank you.
That was intended to be a left-handed compliment.
Yeah, you get the chair. You get a new chair to sit in so you can keep working.
Prop them up. Prop them up.
That's right. Yep.
Unfortunately, I work at Goodwill, so you don't get new chairs. You get old ones.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. And then you get an attaboy because it's Goodwill. I'd like a raise.
Yeah.
How about an attaboy? Give me an attaboy. What a guy. Attaboy.
Yeah.
No raise, just attaboy.
Yeah.
Oh, I worked at I didn't work at Honeywell. I worked at a wholesale distributor. Okay. And we sold plumbing and electrical and heating and all kinds of, and we sold Honeywell products, which going back to that other thing about, I lost it. Where did it go?
Lost it like a job.
Signal gasoline. Signal gasoline turned into Honeywell. And then I sold Honeywell parts because it was part of heating and cooling elements, components for all of these different units. Neat. So weird ties that Gar has to Signal Oil and gasoline.
There you go.
Now, I'm curious. I hung up and I called back because it went dead for me. Did you guys hear what I said? You heard all
about
of that? And then I just... About the last thing that we listened to. I can't remember what it's called. And
heard
I'm
most
on the
of
wrong
what
mouth.
You said when you cut out. It was rather sudden. And you came back like real smooth.
You,
like
you came
nothing
back,
happened.
You came right back, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think the audience had any idea you disappeared.
No, they did not. They did not.
Not a clue.
Yeah, 'cause you were,
only
you were there. You were there, then poof, you were gone. Then you were right back again.
And Dave was like sharing a bunch of facts, and then just around the time he finished, you were back. It was like weird.
Right.
The timing.
That was bizarre. Okay, so the whole little spiel I gave about the 11th hour that did you guys heard that?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I thought I started talking, and then I got muted and dropped and was like, get out of here.
No, I don't know what happened. All of a sudden, left the call or left whatever in the studio.
You know, Gar, that's happened to me before, too, where it seems like I just get locked up and I can't do anything, and I have to literally just, like you did, back out and come back in again.
Yeah, I was like, wait, did I say something wrong? Apologies to Dave.
Uh-huh. as it should be.
Yeah. Well, I don't tend to pop in with that much information on these shows, but I had dug, looked for a little bit of
no, that was great.
On that particular program.
I thought that was great.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, Gar speaks. Wrong mouse. Okay. This is driving me crazy. I got two mice, and I keep grabbing the wrong one. That's what she said.
Quit anyway. Giving them cheese. They won't keep coming back.
I know. and I even came up with a date. February 27th, 1946 was episodes.
Where did you find that? I didn't find that anywhere.
Okay, it said dated as early as 1941 and as late as February 27th, 1946. However, I think what we listened to was one of the first episodes, so it actually would have been closer to 1941. But, you know, everybody was happy with 46, and we ran with it.
Why not? So,
that's what I get for digging stuff up.
That's the problem. Springbok never archived things, so therefore they – by never archiving it, they didn't care when it was. It was done and it was gone, and they didn't keep records of it, let alone the actual recordings. And it took people recording it themselves. Is why as many of those recordings exist as they do, which really is a handful and a half is all. No, I was just going to say, there's not that many South African productions out there available.
Right. The 11th Hour does have several recordings out there. It's on my other computer in another room and with another mouse, and I'm not getting near it. anyway, there are like 8 to 10 existing. There might be more than that. My memory isn't as sharp as I'd like.
Yeah,
I bought a car last week.
Oh, did you? What kind was it?
Yeah. I don't know.
What kind
I'll
was
have
it?
To go look.
What kind
again.
Was it? Oh, what kind
yeah,
was
I'll
it?
Have to
oh,
go look.
It's, yeah. What kind is it? Oh, it's about 10 till 11. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Does it have tires? You know, I don't remember. Let me go look. This was a thing that was really where, I mean, most of the time I kind of laugh off the memory thing, but this was kind of like disheartening. I was like, where did this come from? and I bought three of them. Who told me to buy three? Where did this information? I got it from a good source. I got it from a reliable source. That's in my head. The only thing that's blocked is who the reliable source is.
Yeah, the key piece of information would be...
Yeah, I'm like, who, why, you know? Because these are supposed to be you know, good with this. And then the Dell guy tells me that even some of their connection pins from their power supply to the motherboard are proprietary. And that if you use a generic power supply, that the pin connections could damage the motherboard. And I'm like, what are you guys doing? Are you guys trying to turn into Apple? What the heck, man? Proprietary? Are you guys crazy?
Yeah,
what,
you know? Yeah, you don't use their parts that can screw with your computer, yeah.
Yeah. Well,
that's by design, kiddies. That's by design.
But typically your Dells are a universal, you know, type of board. You can put anything on there, you know. Well, within spec, but, you know, you just have to know the spec. And you guys have talked with me for years now, and you know how wacky I am. And yet I can sit there and go into a computer, rip it apart, put it back together, plug it in, and go, well, there you go, it works. What's that all about?
I don't know.
I do not know. Pure genius? Should we leave it a pure genius?
Yeah, like the absent-minded professor, maybe? I don't know. I can tell you this. I bet if I said, "Hey Dale, I'd like to fix your computer," you'd be like, "No, I'm okay."
Oh, I don't know.
I'll tune it up. You'd be like, "Yeah, you don't even know where your car is. So I don't know."
You know, sometimes it's like a savant. There's some things people are like really, really, really good at, and others they should stay away from. And I try to recognize what to stay away from, like power tools.
Really? I love power tools. Oh,
I got
power tools in the other room. I haven't even unboxed yet.
But I would start to have so much fun with it, I'd forget its actual practical purpose. So.
I've got sawzalls, I've got drills, they're not even out of the box, they're still tied up, and I've had them for months, well, maybe years, I don't, I'll have to go dust them off, find out, but it's weird that I can rip a computer apart. I mean, this thing was seriously flayed open, parts everywhere, and I'm like, yeah, okay, and, you know, put it back together, it's fine. However, my smartphone has a hate relationship with me, where I don't like it, and it acts like it doesn't like me either, and I can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
Darn you, phone.
Yeah. I know. There isn't too much going on with confession between the three of us.
I just refuse.
No.
You got to make me feel guilty first. Good luck with that.
Yeah. Oh, that is a life lesson. That is a life lesson right there.
What's that?
Your responsibility ends at your fingertips, the end of your toes, and the top of your head, front and back. That's it. That's the end of your responsibility. And as far as someone trying to guilt you into something, go, no, that stuff is a rubber ball. Let it bounce off.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just one of the horrors of a human being would be guilting someone into something. Be like, uh-uh, sorry. That was something I picked up over the years.
That is something a narcissistic person tends to do.
You have to also be able to identify it coming.
Yes.
You know, you're just sitting there minding your own business and someone comes up. You know, if you were a nice person, if you did this, no, you recognize it and go, no, go peddle your business elsewhere. Unless you feel within your soul and your spirit, it's like, all right, here we go. Let's do something and help an individual. Then, no, that aspect of guilting someone.
I've worked for companies like that, and I'm not going to get mention which charity or whatever, but you were pretty much strong-armed into, like, they made you jump through all these hoops and sign up on all their things and do all this stuff, even if you wanted to give nothing. It's like they kept... We're here. We want you to contribute. And I hated it. Glad I didn't work there long.
Sounds like Amway.
Yeah. You know,
It felt like Amway.
Yeah. A lot of companies do that with United Way, and then the company gets all the credit for donating all that money, you know.
Yeah.
And like to Jerry's kids, 7-Eleven gives all that money. 7-Eleven gives all that money. People are putting it in the little containers there by the register. You know, come on. You know, give credit to the people that are doing it, not the companies.
Right. Yeah. Oh, I had a... It wasn't a religious moment, but because I don't do that. But I had an awe moment this week as I found out that a 7-Eleven that existed back when I was a kid was torn down last week, and I was like, oh, because one of the memories I had was I was out and about with a friend in high school. We ran out of gas, and my dad had told me earlier that week, if you need anything, you just call. Don't you not call if you need something. So I called from the 7-Eleven. Dad, I'm out of gas. So Dad shows up.
Oh.
I know. So Dad shows up. Here's $5, kid. I can't believe I had to drive all the way out here. Here you go. Get out of here. You know, I'll see you at the house. You know. But it was great because it was a memory. And now, like all things, it's gone.
Yeah.
Torn down.
Well,
I'm not going to go chain myself to a building, you know. but yeah, it's gone. And I don't think there are very few of my childhood homes left. Crazy.
Yeah, things are changing.
But it's like you can't step in the same river twice type thing, you know. Or I went back to Ohio and my city was gone. Did you guys write that? I don't remember. I don't know.
No, that was Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders.
And she's from Akron. And she's from Akron here. And
yep.
That song
oh,
about
my
Akron.
God. Yeah. What's the deal with everything being centrist to Ohio?
Because it
until
is.
I met you,
all,
until I met you guys?
Yeah.
I never knew. I never put 2 and 7 together. Didn't the Lone Ranger come from there?
No, Dean Martin did, though.
Dean Martin did. Well, you put a hat and a mask on him.
Dean Martin did. Roy Rogers did. Doris Day did. Yeah, so many. So many.
Now, I thought the Lone Ranger radio show came out of Ohio, no?
No, I was out of WXYZ Detroit.
Yeah.
Oh. And then they moved to Ohio. No,
but
I don't
know. How many times have we told you, Gar, all roads lead to Ohio?
Yeah,
all roads.
Yeah, you guys even got ties to Superman.
Yeah,
we do.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. The,
it's where he
Simon
started.
And Schuster, not Simon Schuster and Siegel. Siegel
yeah,
and Schuster. No.
Yeah.
Siegel.
yeah. Simon Bar-Sinister? Who? I don't know. Simon
and Garfunkel. No, that's not it. No.
Yeah. Yeah. Apologies to Garfunkel.
Her arms.
Yes. So, I don't know. I talked with Dave. Dave said that last week it was snowing, and this week it's like 90 degrees in Ohio.
Yeah, it was very. True, it was a very nice week weather-wise. Oh my gosh.
And now the weather report. We're high in the sky above Ohio.
All right.
Now, we'll be back in 10 minutes with a different forecast.
That's right.
Yeah,
wait 10 minutes,
Ohio.
We'll get some more gas, and we'll be right back.
That's
you have
Ohio
to bang
weather.
On your chest. Yeah,
if
you have to bang
you
on your
like
chest.
If you don't like Ohio weather, just wait a few minutes.
Yeah. That was the thing, the radio helicopter guy, you just bang on your chest.
This is Bim Barf. We're up here above the city. We're looking down, and seems to be a little bit of traffic down there.
I don't know if that comes
you
through.
You know, I heard Don Imus also spent time here in Cleveland. Then he went away to New York, then he got fired, and he came back here for a short time before he went back to New York. And when he came back, I was listening to one of his bits, and he was doing a helicopter traffic report. But it's not like he was actually outside the helicopter. All you heard was a guy trying to shout over these helicopter blades, you know?
Right, yeah.
It was absolutely hilarious.
That is funny.
Well,
not prepared.
I, I think it was Carlin that showed me that did a bit about banging on your chest while you're talking.
We're high above the city, and it's mighty crazy out here.
It sounds awful.
It does? It doesn't sound good? Okay.
No,
sounds like something else?
Yes, it does.
Oh, well, then I'll stop.
I'll stop.
Now you tell me. After I've been doing it for 20 minutes.
Glasses.
Right.
Careful. Careful, we're going to send you get you some signal gasoline. Taco, yes. Bacon taco there.
There you go.
Every time I get in the helicopter, I get hair in my palms. I don't know what's happening. I don't know. Okay.
Okay.
Seeing that's still not blue. Really? Well, it could be. I don't know. It was clean blue.
It was implied blue.
That's right.
Yes. It was like a sky blue, you know, not all the way there. Yeah.
Every time I get in my helicopter, for some reason I can't see straight. I don't know what's happening.
I need glasses.
I need glasses.
Yes. It's time
what
to
other
stop.
Things
I need
happen?
Glasses.
No. Okay, you'll go blind.
You'll turn to stone. Well, that one has a
you'll
funny
turn
punch
to stone?
Line. Yeah, that has a funny punchline.
Well, I think, well, no, we won't go there. Yeah.
The kid started crying because he thought he was turning to stone.
Yeah.
Figure it out later in the weekend.
Oh, the George Carlin bit. The seven words.
Oh, yeah.
They'll bend your spine, steal your soul. Oh, I can't believe I can't recall that bit. Oh, well, yeah, I have to go look it up. These things that were there yesterday. Just last week when I parked my car that I can't find.
That you just bought.
That I just bought, yeah.
Yeah.
Can't remember what it was, yeah.
Don't remember what it was. Can't find the keys either. Darn, I'm out of luck. I don't even remember what color it was.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, I think I'm going to hop in my helicopter and drive on home.
Someone hand him a tissue.
Man, I'm hearing battle. Oh, well, what's going on with that?
Oh my gosh, this is icky.
That was weird because it used to work. There was some, I don't know, Andy Griffith did helicopter jokes like that. Nobody was like, hey Andy, knock it off.
Well, Floyd did, oh Andy, you didn't do that, Andy.
Yeah.
Cool. Floyd did the helicopter joke, but then again, it was Floyd, so it sounded creepy anyway. But yeah.
Definitely wouldn't let him babysit the grandkids. That's out.
No, the thing with, I bet they had to be really careful in the script writing for Floyd's, you know, dialogue. You know, this is going downhill quick. But yeah, wow. Yeah, poor Floyd. What do you need, Andy? Andy.
That little sigh thing he did, you know?
Yeah, he did that. Oh, man, did he steal that from Jack Benny? I don't know what that was.
Eugene Levy always did a great Howard McNear there.
Yes, he did. Oh, my gosh. I saw a great on one of the Pluto channels. They have a documentary channel, and they did one about National Lampoon. Oh my God, I had no idea of all the madness behind that magazine, which of course Chevy Chase and a lot of the Saturday Night Live people went from writing for National Lampoon to Saturday Night Live and to Second City Television.
Yeah.
Ooh,
well, yeah,
I didn't know that.
Well, the only reason Second City TV came out was because Saturday Night Live was raiding all their Second City people, all their improv people. And so they said, well, we need our own show, otherwise we'll lose everybody.
And that's really how it all kind of came about.
Oh, they were so, they were really the Sam Kinison of the day, because they were way out there. They were doing all kinds of crazy things in what a lot of people would consider poor taste at the time. I'll never forget going to the comic book store, and I see this, you know, over on the magazine rack where there's like a little bit more adult material or adult-like material. Anyway, there's Nash Lampoon. And there's this dog with these sad eyes, and they're holding a gun to its head. It's like, buy this issue or we'll shoot this dog.
Yes. Oh, I saw that. I was like, ooh, what the heck?
I'm like, what the hell?
Well, that's like, you know, that's like one of their record albums, one of their National Lampoon record albums, with this frog that comes out on this cart with no legs, and he's and it's entitled, That's Not Funny, That's Sick. You know?
Yeah.
And that's what National Lampoon very much was.
And in this documentary, they actually did a cartoon of it, they animated it with the frog coming out.
Oh, did they?
Rolling on the cart, you know?
French restaurant, frog legs, yeah.
There you go.
And then Chevy Chase later starred in the movie National Lampoon's Vacation or whatever.
Yes. Yeah, the magazine was still going, I guess, pretty good at the time. It was spiraling out of control. One of their writers was found mysteriously dead on the island of Maui, I believe, at the bottom of a canyon. They don't know if he was abusing drugs at the time, so they don't know if he was like incredibly high and just it was an accident, or whether it was a suicide. You know, no one knows. And it bothers Chevy Chase. It still bothers Chevy Chase to this day. He was very close to this guy, whose name alludes.
And only that guy can. If only that guy had confessed before he did that, you know, we
know.
That's true.
There's your
know.
Moral,
you know.
There's your moral right there.
If only, was Elvira Cassandra Patterson?
Yeah.
Was she in SCTV, or she was just on the?
No.
She was in a comedy troupe. The Wranglers or something. I forget what it's called. I don't remember. She was in a comedy troupe with a Pee Wee Herman guy and a few other people. I'm surprised that they didn't have some type of.
Are we back to Pee Wee Herman? Are we back to that topic again?
When were we last on that topic? About 2 weeks
ago. I don't remember.
When you were imitating helicopters.
Oh, really? This is Pee Wee Herman.
Do you follow me?
No.
Are
we back on that topic again?
That wasn't Pee Wee Herman. That was Paul Rubens.
Oh,
yes,
that's
exactly.
Different. Yeah, that's different.
Yeah, that's
somehow
right.
Somehow that's different. I don't know.
No darkened theaters for Pee Wee Herman, I tell you.
No.
Or maybe not. I don't know. Yeah. Better than a helicopter. Yeah. Yep.
I like going to movie theaters and sneaking up behind people and going, ha!
Oh, man. I love going to theaters and smacking people in the head when they go, ha! I just
good.
Smack them in the head.
There you go.
We got to meet sometime, Dale.
Yeah.
In a theater.
I think we should. That would be fun.
Which is not that far away from, hi-ho, Dudley Do-Right here. That guy, you know, not too far away.
No, not
know?
Too.
Yep.
And my beautiful friend, Nell, and my horse.
Oh, horse. I'll save you, sweet Nell.
There you go.
Yeah, who does? There you go. That's it. Yeah.
Well done.
Crazy. Dave, did Hans Conried. Did he do a boatload of radio, didn't he?
He did, yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We've had him on a few times here.
And he did everything from comedy to dramatic roles. I mean, he was
not Candy Matson, but there was another detective. Oh, you know what? It was he was the father in one of those Jack Webb, the defrocked father who helped Jack Webb out in one of his series. But he did a lot of comedy as well, and he did a lot of straight roles. It was just he was very he could cross the line so easily. It's unbelievable.
Yes. He was in so many not just radio, but he was also in so many television programs. It was just
His voice is just one of those you just never forget. You know, I think it's all in, especially guys our age, folks our age, it's indelibly buried in your conscience of that guy's voice.
Yeah, one of my favorite episodes of. The Night Stalker, although I can't say I have the favorite. If I did, it would have to be probably Chopper. But the Black Knight, because not only did it have John Daner, a great radio personality, but it also had Hans Conried in it. Hans Conried was the caretaker of the museum.
Nice.
And he had one of those voices that if you like to imitate voices, he's a voice that I personally find difficult. I find Vincent Price difficult, too.
Yeah.
I love their voices, and there's this untouchable quality to their voice that I haven't been able to duplicate.
You know what? Gar, that's a great way to put it, an untouchable quality, because there's that handful, like Paul Frees or, you know, Hans Conried.
Yes.
That voice is just magical and instantly recognizable.
It's instantly recognizable, but he did so many different things with it. Sometimes he had, you know, a different type of accent, or a Russian accent, or a Middle European accent, or it was straight up, you know, whatever he did with it. And Paul Frees, of course, had so many different voices that I think it's kind of hard to copy them because they were so vast in their vocal abilities.
Very versatile, yeah.
And I found it amazing that Paul Frees is in one horror movie. You can find he's in one. And it was like really it was kind of brief, but I was like, whoa, they have this guy? You know,
Was that War of the Worlds, the 54 War of the Worlds?
I think it might have been the Monster versus the Navy or something like that. Wasn't War of the Worlds. It was a very There's a movie called The Monsters versus the Navy or something.
Navy,
like that.
Yeah. Good. That's stinko.
And really, oh yeah. No,
I was rooting for the Navy the whole time.
I know. Yeah, crazy, isn't it? In this movie, he is a professor. He's a science guy, and he grows a mold that he cannot control. And it grows out of control and consumes him, and then starts eating the countryside or something like that. It's a very bizarre thing. They only gave him screen time for like, you know, 15, 20 minutes. It's like it was Paul Frees. They should use him all the way to the end. You know, I would.
Well, it could be that he had so many things obligated. He came in and did most of his scenes in a day or two, and then ran off to do other stuff.
Yeah.
True. I would have
based on that
days.
Movie, him showing up at all it did that movie a favor.
and it was I just saw him and I was like, wait a second, that's Paul Frees, and bigger, and it was. Saw it 2 weeks ago. everything's 2 weeks ago. All right, guys, it's 11:14. I guess it's ready to bring in.
I can't believe I'm up this late. Wow, man.
Howie Mandel. Who's Howie Mandel? No, that's a comedian. He put the glove on his face and hurt himself.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey kids, don't put a glove on your face. Okay, we're done. That was it.
Let us do
it. PSA. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Don't put a glove on your face. Come on down here. Let professionals help you out.
That's right.
But you have to confess first.
We'll make sure it's a nice, tight fit.
It will. I tell you, it'll be like you're not even breathing.
Yeah. Your parents will be so glad. You'll be so quiet at night, they'll be very happy.
I'm not really sure, and I'm sure we'll get letters, right? Yeah. How many letters are you getting lately, Dale? did he like damage his eyes or something with the pressure or his ears?
Who?
Howie Mandel putting the glove on his head.
I don't know.
He put a surgical glove on his head, and then
he blew out of his
nose and blew it up. And then later it was found that he was actually harming his head and his eyes and his brain and stuff. And then I was like, well, maybe we won't do that. Huh? He's very, yes, very much. Maybe it made his hair fall out, too.
That's what I'm thinking.
I don't know if putting a glove on your head and blowing would take your hair out, but kids, don't try this at home.
No.
That's all we can say, you know. Don't put a glove on your head. There's a lot of things that, you know, don't run with the scissors up your nose. You might fall. It would be bad.
Yeah. Well, it'd be fun to watch, but it would be, you wouldn't.
It'd be, no, it wouldn't. No. Oh, look. There goes his nose. Wow. Who knows?
I told you I can do that dark comedy when I have to.
Wow. We go there, but we keep it clean. Unless you're in a helicopter.
We dance around the minefield a little bit from time to time.
I can't believe that doesn't work. I'm going to try that on Horrible Horror tomorrow and see if they feel it's not a helicopter or not.
Oh, God.
Isn't this a helicopter? Are you guys feeling what I'm feeling? Because I'm miles above the 50.
Depending on how you depict this, this could get really, really ugly, Gar.
Very quickly.
You could lose your PG rating right now, I'm telling you.
I don't know.
You want to be careful how you emulate that sound while on video.
I always thought that was a helicopter. I don't know where I got it. I don't know. Nipsey Russell might have done it. I don't know who did it. Somebody did it. And I was like, oh, that's a helicopter. I can do that.
Nipsey Russell.
Miles above the city. We're looking down.
Who's that one cat that he can imitate damn near any sound?
There's a police academy
guy.
He just recently died. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Was he talented.
Was he talented?
He
was on
man.
Police Academy. So funny.
First time I saw him was actually in a Cheech and Chong movie. He had a bit role.
Okay. Let's just say you're high, and this guy to the right of you is making noises with his mouth like stuff is happening.
That's exactly what happened in the movie.
That would blow your mind. I mean, you just have to go, no, I'm sorry, I need to go jump off a cliff or something.
Well, Cheech was in a straitjacket, and he was under the influence of something.
In a straitjacket.
And this guy's making these noises, and he's going crazy. It's hilarious. Good comedy.
Man. Yeah, good stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Remember, kids, never get in a straitjacket.
Those two guys, the way they met, too, it was odd.
Cheech and Chong, or the guy that made noises and Chong?
Cheech and Chong. No, Cheech and Chong.
Cheech and
how
Chong.
They met was kind of weird and like fluky.
I didn't even understand what it was, but it was funny to me as a child because I had no reference. And I listened to it because my parents had the record, and I listened to it, and I was like, oh, man. Like, what are these things that keep falling out of the record album here? Kind of weird.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, yeah. But you know, all these little seeds, what's going on? Weird place for seeds. But no, that was it. That one of the album covers opened up, and it was like them in a car, and you open it up, and it's the inside of the car, and it's loaded with paraphernalia and stuff.
Yes.
Very highbrow humor.
The record album looked like, and inside was a giant rolling paper.
Oh,
I tipped the hat to one of their, or they alluded to it in one of their movies because they rolled a giant one of those things.
Yeah, there's a funny little bit they did
and
about
Pee Wee Herman got to start with them too. As a matter of fact, he appeared in one of their films way before he was Pee Wee Herman on TV. He was
He
was an annoying waiter.
He was annoying.
In one of them, or not a waiter, excuse me, a hotel, like a bellboy guy.
And he was doing his Pee-wee voice.
You know, Paul Rubens.
Yeah, but did he ever, was he ever in a circus? I thought he did It's the Lizard Man, where they had somebody that turned into a lizard.
Yes, Stacy Keach was chasing him, and they ended up getting him high, and I don't know if it was that he thought he was a lizard or he actually turned into a lizard. But, yeah. That was the second movie,
I
think. I think that was the second movie. Stacy Keach was chasing him through the whole movie, and at the end he turns into a Lizard Man. And
you know it's going to be a weird...
They were calling him the Hamburger Dude because they met him in a restaurant.
Yes.
He was saying weird shit, and he kept going, Hamburger! For like no reason.
Yes.
No apparent reason.
You know it's going to be a weird film when you go in the movie theater. It's a Cheech and Chong film. They show the Columbia lady and someone does a wolf call to her.
Yes.
In the audience, you go, okay, it's going to be a hilarious movie. Okay, yeah. That actually happened. I was a wolf call at the Columbia lady. Okay.
Which
sure.
Who knew that years later the Animaniacs would have like a breeze blow by and Lady Liberty's skirt would blow up?
There's another one where Lady Liberty is like attacked by somebody and she takes her lantern and beats the heck out of them.
Good. That's good stuff.
Oh, I'll have to find that and send it to you, Dale. I'll do that on the Facebook thing.
Okay, cool.
Because that's crazy. Yeah. I don't know what it's from or what the illusion is, but yes, you see the silhouette of these two guys coming up to Lady Liberty, and she beats the heck out of them. And then she resumes her
war cartoon or something like. There's a lot of the propaganda Warner Brothers stuff, which is now very. It's really.
Oh, it was a Pepe Le Pew cartoon. That's right. Yeah, no.
Something like that. No.
Something like that.
The wartime cartoons really they had very bad depictions of the enemy. No one minds Hitler or Mussolini because that's one person, but for the Japanese, they really kind of spoof the whole race in a very stereotypical way.
Yes.
Yeah, he did.
Which, by the way, if you're listening in the archive, our 500th show is going to be an all-music show, and we're going to ask everybody to keep in mind, keep the framework of when this stuff came out. We're not trying to, offend anyone. We're just playing historically what was available at the time.
There's some stuff that was definitely not politically correct that went on, but again, it was a war effort and we had been attacked and one of the ways to win the war, to get the people behind you is through humor, and unfortunately hit up on the whole Japanese race there.
Yeah, I just watched a Warner Brothers cartoon, and I'm like, you guys know I have a pretty damn thick skin, and I was even like taken aback, like, whoa. But I, still trying to understand the framework of the time that it came out and that we had been attacked. But it was like, wow, I didn't mind them hitting on, you want to take a stab at Hitler or Mussolini, they're individuals who were doing very bad things, but you can't believe that every single member of one particular group, whatever it is, be it a religion, be it a race, be it a country, I can't, anyway, believe that every person in it is bad. I just can't. It's just not possible to me.
I have a weird art lesson that I've explained to individuals about our differences. And here's one of the curious things, is if you look at a human face and you put your index finger under your nose and your thumb under your chin, and you move it up. Then you're at your bottom of your nose and at your eyebrow, and you move that up, and you keep that space. You hit your hairline. And there are other proportions of a human face that are relatively at the same. And so it's our sameness we need to pay attention to. And differences are amazing, and people are unique, and that's. But we're also very much more similar than we are dissimilar, and so come together, not stay apart.
Come together, and
that's for everyone. It doesn't matter where you come from. That particular art lesson is fairly right on target. Everyone's proportions. Now there are some variations where there are some people that due to a genetic problem are not going to fit that. But for the most part, I would say 98% of individuals are going to hold with the ratios of the face. So if we're that similar, I mean, there are differences. The nose is a bigger, wider, taller, shorter, whatever.
Yeah.
Same with eyes and mouth. But typically, that thing about the proportions and ratios are right there. Otherwise, these programs that are doing facial recognition and stuff, they wouldn't work. But they have to have those things in order to identify that aspect that's in an image. So they have to have, you know, these things in line.
Yeah.
You know. It doesn't work for the elephant, man.
They're going to cut us off shortly, guys, so we probably ought to wrap it up.
So we'll end with an art lesson. There you go. And the City Slickers, Spike Jonze and the City Slickers, their big jump was in the Fuhrer's Face thing, that song.
Oh,
that one got them really.
We got a worse one for them. Yeah, they did worse stuff than that.
Yeah.
And you'll hear it.
And we'll hear it, yes. until tomorrow, we got to bring in the one and only Schnozola before they cut us off.
Good night.
Good night.
It's time to say
never.
Good night.
High above the city.
Good night. What more to say but good night? We've had a few laughs, and it's time for toodaloo. Horrible, what we the same, and inconsequent. Good night.
Fair skies and happy sailing.
And good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever.
Back to you, Jim.
Bye-bye.